So we won't do any additional prayers before we start this afternoon, but let's just take a minute to kind of strengthen our motivation, to remember this motivation that we generated earlier today, thinking that we're here to develop some deeper understanding of the Buddha's teachings, particularly as they're presented in this Noble Eightfold Path. And we're doing this because we ourselves, admittedly, want happiness, don't want to suffer. But moreover, this is the same for every single sentient being. We're not unique in any way in that regard. So if we can generate that motivation of being here for the sake of all beings, thinking that we're working on ourselves so we can be better at helping others, leading them to true happiness and true peace. Okay, good. So, any comments from the lunch break? Any further thinking about the clothespin? Those of you who weren't here in the morning, this is my little tool for demonstrating emptiness. Yes, Andreas. Andreas. Probably, yeah.
So, I just had a question. When you were putting the clothespin together again,
right?
You said you didn't add anything else, right?
Correct.
But I think you did. You added your knowledge because it's just a clothespin because of the way it's built,
right?
If you will put the pieces together differently, then it will be something different. So it's the same with our bodies. It's not
in
the cells that build our bodies or our limbs. The relationship between the parts, it's what made us.
Yeah, I mean I see what you're saying to some degree, but I guess again the idea is to still come back to that. What we're trying to investigate is whether something can establish itself. In other words, what we call self-identity. Do things establish themselves, or are they requiring other factors to be established? And again, we looked at the three levels of the first, the causes and conditions that are necessary for it to be established. Then we looked at the parts. And then the idea behind the last part is really when we do have things coming together, just as this body all came together from its causes and conditions and so on, has all of its various parts as a basis now for this designation, is to see where does the identity really come from then? So in saying that I wasn't adding anything, my knowledge or my awareness is an additional factor, but that's in terms of my ability to then designate this properly. You know, if I went around and saying this is a hammer, you know, if I advertised on the paper in the paper that I had a hammer for sale, and then when people showed up, I'd say, "Here, are you interested in my hammer?" They'd be like, "You're crazy. This isn't a hammer. This doesn't serve the function of a hammer. It's not a suitable basis for a hammer." They wouldn't say those terms, maybe, but the idea is that this doesn't meet the criteria for what we call hammer. And so what we call a clothespin is exactly the same. Just as there's no real hammer here, there's no real clothespin here either. Because clothespin is simply a designation we're giving to this collection of stuff that, sure, is assembled this way. So I'm adding that knowledge, if you will, that information that is our collective agreement that we're going to call this clothespin because it is that which, you know, serves to help clothes hang online so they can dry. I mean, whatever definition you'd want to give to a clothespin. So there is an element of knowledge, but that's really in the domain then of our conceptual awareness, our conceptual designation. One phrase that I used right after the teaching ended when I was talking with folks is I've never heard a Tibetan teacher use this language, but it's as though we organize the world, and we need to have an organized world, right? We need to know that I'm not going to start calling this hammer, and you think of it as pliers, and someone else think of it as, you know, whatever. I mean, we need to have some agreement on what things are, because we live in a world where we do have to communicate and relate to each other, and so it's helpful to have labels being put on things. But we organize the world this way, and we all learned how to organize the world when we were quite young, right? We learned all the names of various things. There's a four-legged animal that came in, and we go, "Oh, what's that, mommy," or whatever, and they go, "That's a dog." And then a cat comes in, and you go, dog. And you go, no, that's a cat. You know, it's got four legs, but it's different. And you learn kind of how to differentiate all the things in our world. But once we differentiate them through hearing their names for them, then we think that they are that, that their identity is established from those things, like they were there waiting for us to discover their real name. And someone pointed out even that in the Bible, one of the first tasks that God gives to Adam was to name all the animals and name all the, you know, things in the world. Well, just by the fact that we have to name things means that their identity isn't established, because otherwise we would have the identity appearing to us the moment that we came into contact with it. We wouldn't even have to learn a name for something. Once we learn the name for something, as I said, we think that suddenly it's like that name absorbs into the phenomenon. So once we learn that this is clothespin, it's like clothespin becomes a part of this entire thing. It's like an overlay that is on this, that screams clothespin at us every time that we see it. It says clothespin, clothespin, clothespin. I can't think of this as being anything but clothespin, because that's the identity that we've given to it and the identity that it seems to have. So the only thing we're really adding is that label, that designation. But then there is this little trick that happens by virtue of our ignorance having been around for so long, which is that the label absorbs into the basis and seems to be one with it. And we agree to that. We think that this is clothespin from its own side. It's got its own identity. In fact, what I'm holding in my hand is not clothespin at all, because clothespin is simply a label I put on these parts assembled in this way. There is no clothespin in my hand, no real clothespin in my hand. Well, sure, what we designated clothespin, no problem, because again, we organize the world and we have to relate to things. When somebody needs a clothespin and they ask for one, I happily give them this. But there's no real clothespin in my hand. There's no real I sitting here. There's no real body. There's no real mind. This is why when you recite the Heart Sutra, many of you know the Heart Sutra, we go through all the list of things. You know, there's no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no smell, no taste. We go through all the list of all the various things, and what we mean by that is there's nothing that is established from its own side. Another example I like to use in teaching on this view of emptiness that, again, is so key, it being, again, one of these four seals of Buddhism on your sheet there, is the idea of that was put out really quite clearly in this film, The Gods Must Be Crazy. I don't know if any of you recall that film. It's a really nice film in the beginning. The rest of the film, it kind of gets a little weird. I didn't think it was that enjoyable as a film. Don't go out and like buy it or anything. If you have an opportunity to watch it someday, if you haven't seen it, it's kind of interesting. In the beginning, there's a small plane that's flying over the Kalahari Desert, and there's two pilots there, and the one is finishing up a bottle of Coca-Cola, and he flings the bottle out the window, and it goes, you know, flying down and lands in the Kalahari Desert, and the bushman of the Kalahari sees this thing fall from the sky and has no context for what this is, right? Because doesn't live in a culture where Coca-Cola bottled in that way would be something that he would have any experience with. So he goes over and, you know, is poking around it, not even sure where this came from, thinks it's a gift from the gods, and grabs the bottle and eventually starts putting it to various uses, takes it back to his kinsfolk, and they're using it to smooth out snake skins and using it to pound up grain and doing all these various things with it. And of course the audience, you know, myself included, when I was watching it, were like, oh, how clever they're using this Coca-Cola bottle for all these things. But do they think they're using a Coca-Cola bottle for anything? No, they have no knowledge of Coca-Cola bottle. It lacks any inherent existence as Coca-Cola bottle. It even lacks inherent existence as glass. It's simply, for those people, they labeled it something different. They began to use it with different purposes. They thought it was a gift from the gods in order to do all these things. Of course, from there, the film goes on, because the problem is that gods only gave them one Coca-Cola bottle or one tool, and so they have all this stuff going on about everyone wanting to use it and there only being one. So the point of that whole little sharing that was that, again, there's nothing from the side of the object that makes it what it is. It is our designation of that. So we all see it and identify it as Coca-Cola bottle, but someone else could see it and identify it as something completely different, and it's equally valid for that person as it is for us to designate it as what they designate it as versus what we designate it as. there's no problem with them being equally valid because they're simply imputations, designations. As I said, if we have in a community an agreed upon label for what we're going to call a particular item, and somebody goes against that, then it's problematic because then they're no longer in accord with conventional agreement. But this doesn't have to be clothespin. Again, as I was mentioning, I could use it to close up a bag of snacks. I could use it as decoration, right? You could paint it and make it into little people or whatever, and little arms on them with, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? It's like there's nothing that, and this is a very simple way of talking about it, but those are pointing out that things can't be inherently what they appear to us as, or they would always be that, unchangingly be that. Even when I talk about emptiness, sometimes I use the idea, this was from another teacher I had, so that if you had a dog in the room, for example, and if I threw this across the room and a dog went running to get it, might have fun chewing on it for a while. When I got to the metal, it might not be so much fun. But it might, see, this is chew toy, right? We call it chew toy. Dog wouldn't even call it as chew toy. It's whatever. It's got some other conceptual designation, some other way of thinking about it. No names, necessarily, because a dog doesn't have great language skills, but it's referring to this through the lens of its own conceptual framework, and it's chewing on it and having a good time chewing on the clothespin and totally content with it being what it is for the dog. And we would look at it again and say, why is your dog chewing on your clothespin? You're like, well, but the dog doesn't think, oh, I'm chewing on the clothespin, right? Well, I don't know what the dog thinks, but I don't think the dog thinks that. So I don't know if I completely answered your question by that whole diatribe. We are adding to a degree that there's nothing here, again, that is clothespin. Clothespin is an added designation. And if you didn't know what this was, again, you'd have an appearance of something, and you might be able to, if you knew that there was wood, because you've experienced wood before and you have also some experience of what metal is, you might be able to say that. But if you didn't, went to a culture where they'd never seen clothespins before, they might not necessarily get what this is. That's once more proof that it can't be inherently clothespin, or else it would be evident what it is. We'd know it already. So it can't be something that is clothespin from the side of what's in my hand, or we'd all know it is clothespin. And another simple proof that things can't have their own existence. They can't be self-established. When we hear these teachings, sometimes I think we go, well, but I don't think of things that way. But we have to check up and see to what degree is this ignorance really there that we, especially again with regard to the sense of I, how concrete do you think you exist? Most of us think we're pretty concrete, or we wouldn't be getting into the trouble that we're getting into. We think that there's something here that is self-established that we need to defend, that we need to protect, that we need to engage in all these various activities in order to please. And no such phenomenon exists. There is an I, there is a clothespin, there are all these things, but they're only designated, only imputed. Yeah, Denise?
Thanks for this example. It's great, and I've never heard it before. The clothespin, wonderful. It occurred to me, after your question, that our conventional understanding of what pieces go together to make a clothespin, even if we say it is something we're adding, we hold that before the pieces get assembled. So we have that even before the moment when it's still laying in the three pieces.
Sure.
So even though we hold that, it's not enough to complete it to be, you know, this idea until we put it
right
together. So that's not the piece that's making it. The clothespin.
But we do have that idea before. Again, when I took these apart, we could say,
this is
a piece of a clothespin, this is a piece of a clothespin, that is a piece of a clothespin. Well, where's the clothespin that they're a piece of?
Right.
I mean, we even think that that's somehow inherently there, but it isn't. One teacher, I think it was a Venerable Fedor, do you have an IKEA here? You know,
we're
what
about
IKEA
to.
Like you go to IKEA and you go, well, I'm going to get a table. Well, what you walk out with isn't really a table, right? But you pay for a table, and you are confident that when you walk out of there, you got a table for your money. But you didn't get a table. You got all the pieces of a table. But they're not even, where is the table that they're a piece of? Well, it doesn't exist at the time when you buy the pieces, right? The pieces are, you get the little guide of how you assemble it and put it all together, and then you have a table when all the pieces are put there. But we think quite instinctively that there's a table that they're all pieces of before the table's even there. And we're quite happy to buy it saying table on the box when it's not really table, it's the pieces of a table that doesn't exist yet.
That's true.
So we have to be kind of more critical of how we're looking at things and really examine. And as I said, tables and clothespins and all this are probably not the biggest problem for us. We do have attachment to a lot of physical objects in our world. But we wouldn't have attachment to those objects if we weren't clinging to the sense of self. Because the attachment and the anger and all the other delusions are arising on the basis of that false view of a self. This clinging to this self-existent I, yeah, that we think has some sort of eternal existence. And again, if we look at the reality of even just impermanence, we can see very clearly that things don't continue. I mean, the person that you are will come to an end. The consciousness that is together with that person, that is this thread of awareness that goes through that life, continues on. But as we pointed out in examining earlier today, that can't be the I either. I mean, because it isn't any unitary, identifiable thing that is entirely the I. The way we think of I, when you think I am whoever, all that identity stuff that we were talking about, all that clinging to our view of ourselves, when we think in that way, it's not as if we think, oh, that's my mind and that's my body, and it's rather entirely us, a unitary phenomenon, and yet we find no equivalent to it. We don't find anything we can point to and say, ah, there's the I. So in a sense, the I that we are is a conditional phenomenon on the basis of you were born into this life, parents gave you a name, you have an identity around your gender, your nationality, whatever, all the various factors. You carry that identity to the end of this life, and then that all falls away, and your consciousness goes on to another existence, and will have a whole new set of identities that are formed around the body and mind and so on that you have at that time. And by mind, I mean the grosser levels of awareness. You know, so there's really no evidence that we have a sort of inherently existent I if we start poking around, start looking at all the various ways that we're quite mistaken in adhering to that. And it's the same again with all phenomena. So I don't know if we are ready to move on or not. Do we have any other questions? Yeah, Andre? Wait for just 1 second. Okay. Oh.
No, that's okay.
I'm not so much sure if it's a question, but it's like it occurs to me that the problem that we have with these things is the designation itself when it changes, right?
Okay.
So I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, my wife and I, we don't hang clothes out anymore.
Sure.
We have these things, but for us, it's a bag clip.
Right.
Now, if I insist that it's a bag clip and someone insists that it's a clothespin, we can get in some trouble there, right? Because the other person doesn't want to let go of the notion or the idea that this is a clothespin, although it doesn't function that way anymore for most people.
Sure. But I think you can, depending upon the phenomenon, you could have greater or lesser conflict in regard to those sorts of things. Some things kind of fall out of renown as a particular thing, like clothespins. At some point, maybe nobody's going to really have them as clothespins. Maybe they sell them, and most people use them as bag clips, and maybe they'll start labeling the bag that they're sold in as that, you know, 100 bag clips or whatever, rather than 100 clothespins. But yeah, people are adhering really strongly to that identity. In this case, I mean, we can't deny that things sometimes do serve multiple functions.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Look at tires. I mean, a tire is quite good on a car when it's all functional, but you can take that tire and you can put it on the ground and fill it with concrete and make it into a pylon or something, or you could fill it with dirt and make it into a planter, you know, put flowers in it or what have you. So, you know, we don't have so many problems, I think, sometimes when things that we see as one thing get used in another way. But you're right, when we start to change the label on it, then it becomes another issue sometimes, because we still see it, just like people watching that Coca-Cola bottle being used by people in different ways, still see it through the lens of it being inherently a Coca-Cola bottle.
And so I'm thinking in terms of how we view ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, these roles or these labels we place on ourselves.
Right.
We were having this conversation at Nash Correctional the other day with the students. We're talking about this very thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this guy says he labeled himself as a good guy. Right? I am a good guy. Yeah. And the problem comes when someone says, well, no, you're not a good guy. I mean, you're in prison, so you're not, you know.
Right.
And it's so, like, that you know, he's clinging to this notion that I'm a good guy.
Right. Sure.
And there are times when he is a good guy.
Yeah.
And there are times when he wasn't,
yeah.
You know. And so that's when we get into conflict. You know,
absolutely.
Cause we, yeah.
No, those are very good points.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we're dealing with, again, we don't want to say that none of the point that we can't take away from this is that our labeling is somehow invalid. Our labeling serves a purpose. And for example, with the case you're talking about, it does help someone to think of themselves as a good person, because
right.
that will be how they end up manifesting in the world. They'll try to embody what it means to be a good guy.
Right.
Just like when we talk about at the very beginning of this, when we looked at the mind having this potential for Buddhahood, this is a very different concept for a lot of people in the West who think that fundamentally they're flawed. Fundamentally, at the deepest level, there's something wrong with them, whereas the Buddha says, yes, you do have some impurities there, some things that are obstructing, but your fundamental nature is Buddhahood, is Buddha nature. You know, your fundamental nature is good. So, I mean, I think there's usefulness to a lot of these labels and to maybe even doing things that are somewhat contradictory to what the rest of the world might hold. So we're not saying we always have to adhere to the way the rest of the world views things.
Right.
You know, rather we find what is true for us and what has more basis in reality, because there is still conventional reality. We can't deny conventional reality. We have to use conventional reality to get enlightened.
Yeah.
You know, by understanding the deepest way that things exist, or this lack of them existing inherently, but we do still have to work within the confines of conventional reality. So this is why, going back to this whole idea of right view or understanding, this is a conceptual framework. These are also merely designated, merely imputed ideas, but they are much more constructive and beneficial than a lot of the other merely imputed ideas that we had that weren't based in reality, that could actually be shown to be false. Like, for example, thinking that everyone's to blame for my suffering. You know, everyone who bothers me, everyone who annoys me, everyone who disagrees with me, they're all wrong. I'm the only one that's right. Well, that's not a very helpful view. You know, it doesn't get us very far. So these are great comments on all this. Thank you for that, Andre. Yeah, Peter, the microphone's on its way.
So I'm just trying to wrap my mind around this. So that, if there's no I, which we know there is, not an I intellectually, then what you're left with is basically your mental experience of your karma. Is that what's left?
Well, again, when we say there's no I, we always have to be real clear in saying there is no I existing in this particular way, meaning as something self-established, set up from its own side. Rather, the I does exist. The whole point of, maybe I didn't make this quite clear, but the whole point of going through the three levels of dependent arising for the clothespin, to understand that it arises from causes and conditions, it also depends on parts, it also in the end depends upon that designation, was to really get that things still do exist. And if I talked about the I that is here that I'm referring to myself, I can say I arise on the basis of causes and conditions too. There's a lot of causes and conditions to why this person named Don is here. There's also the parts of Don, which would be the body and mind, and then all those parts that are parts of the body and mind. And then also there's this basis of designation, which is the body and mind that I'm thinking of as I. So at no point do I deny the I existing at all.
As a basis.
As an existent phenomenon.
Right.
As something that we can say does exist. I'm just getting at how does it exist. Because the mistaken idea that we have is not that the I exists at all. It's just that we think the I exists inherently or intrinsically. Meaning that it sets itself up again. That somehow there's something here that is findable as the I and is concretely here as the I. Rather, the way that you exist, this is you and every other being, is only by designation. But what we would call this is nominal existence, which is very different from objective existence. Objective existence is entirely from the side of the object that is being referred to. So I is here in front of you from its own side. Whereas I is really only here because we're thinking of this as I. And it's perfectly valid to think of this as I. That's what we have to also understand, is it's not like there's something wrong with our imputation.
Right.
I mean, if I thought that I was that cushion on the thing there, then that would be an invalid imputation. Because that's not what I would think of as I. I think of this stuff as I.
Right.
But to think that there's a real I here is fiction.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out, okay, so what's left? What's really there, right?
Well, what's left is, again, left is maybe not the best way to put it. What is actually there is a merely imputed I, a merely designated I, on a basis. Now, there is always a basis, because as I said, I mean, I can't say I'm out in the hallway right now, because the basis for the I isn't out in the hallway. The basis for the I is sitting in this chair. So the basis has to be there, but the basis is simply what is designated as I, what is thought of as I. There's nothing from the side of this basis that makes it an I, that establishes it as an I. This is tricky stuff. This, by the way, those of you who might be new to these teachings, you might be scratching your head and going, God, I don't think I'll ever get it. You will get it, but it takes repeated teachings and repeated, you know, reading on it and meditating on it and digesting it and working with it, and year after year after year of doing this, trust me, I mean, I'm still in the process of discerning the full import and meaning of all of this. But when we get down to it, if we use this phrase, what's left, what exists in the end is just this mere designation on these other phenomena that are also merely designated. Because as I said, body is a label we put under this collection of stuff. Mind is a label we put on the collection of all the mental moments. Even a mental moment is a designation we put on a particular duration of consciousness that has various things arising within it.
Yeah, I think I get that. I'm just trying to. What keeps occurring to me is like it's like a one big river. I mean, if you start thinking about your next life or incarnation, right?
Sure.
It all basically runs together.
And none of it is inherently you. You're thinking of, there's a thought of I throughout that whole process. But the overlay that we think that the I is really there is the faulty mind, is the ignorance we're trying to uproot. But if we have the idea that there's simply this flow of stuff that we are thinking of as I, merely designated as I, then we wouldn't have this strong sense of needing to defend that. We wouldn't have strong attachment to the pleasurable things in our lives and strong aversion to the unpleasant things in our lives. Because there's no basis for those emotions to arise, because we've deflated that sense of I that is so prominent that causes us to get attachment and aversion and jealousy and pride and everything else. But it has to be deconstructed at a pretty deep level to get to that. And that's why, again, initially it might feel like, well, I kind of get it, but it doesn't really seem to hit home. I mean, I hear this from students all the time. And it's the reality that it takes a while for you to get it down to that level where you sort of have that, I don't know if realization is quite the right word, but some level of an aha that you see that, okay, this is what we're talking about. And you just have to do that through experience. I can't tell you that necessarily. I don't think any teacher can tell you that. But rather you can see it for yourself by practicing again and again. The one book, I hate to throw book titles at people all the time, but there really are so many useful resources out there in regard to a number of the subjects we're going to touch on this weekend. But in regard to emptiness, I would say one of the best ones, in my estimation, is the book that His Holiness wrote called How to See Yourself as You Really Are. And Jeffrey Hopkins assisted him with that. And to me, it's just a really good analysis of all of this. One other example, and I really do need to move on, we're only going to have one step to a happy life over the course of the weekend. And maybe that's good enough, but, you know, one example that's used by Lama Tsongkhapa, and I think even he's quoting Chandrakirti, a great Indian master from, I think, the 6th century. Anyway, the one example is this idea that if you're on, it's like a dark night, and you're out in your garden or something, so it's dusk or later, so you can't quite see well enough. There's no light or anything yet. The moon hasn't come up. And you see over in a corner this coiled, striped thing. And you have the immediate thought, oh, my God, there's a snake. And then, of course, you turn on the porch light or something, and you look, and it's just a coiled rope. Or we might even have a garden hose or something nowadays. But you see that it is not actually a snake. What Tsongkhapa says is, in the same way that there's no snake on that coiled rope, it's the same way that there's no snake on what we actually designate as a snake. But they nonetheless are different phenomena that we would want to have fear and some sort of caution around what is actually a snake versus what is a coiled rope we wouldn't have any fear of necessarily. They do have different ways that we should be reacting to them. But nonetheless, from the side of that coiled rope, just as there's no snake from the side of that coiled rope, there's also no snake from that coiled body of that being that we call a snake. I don't know if that hits home for people in a different way, but it does kind of contrast this idea of what we would see as what we think is a mistake in regard to the coiled rope. We're actually making a mistake even with regard to what we call a snake, because we think it's a real snake. We think it has snakeness from its own side. We've given it that label, and again, we'll respect things that are in line with that label and not anger those snakes so that they bite us or whatever, differently from the coiled rope. But still, there is no identity of snake from the side of those parts and the body of that being, in the same way that there's no snake on the side of that coiled rope. So you have to get pretty far in your analysis to get to that level where you really see everything is really just designated, just labeled. And by the way, I did mention language earlier, but as I alluded to earlier, language is a part of it, but language isn't the sum total of it. Because I would say even beings, like I said, dogs and that, I'm sure they have some conceptual framework when they're chewing on something like this, that they're thinking about it. Not as complex as our thought processes, and they don't have, again, the language to go with that. But even infants, when you have a newborn child that's breastfeeding, I'm sure it knows what breast milk is and screams for it without the label. Doesn't sit there and go, Mom, give me some breast milk. And it doesn't have that way of designating it, but it still has a conceptual framework around that. Because you don't need language to designate things. So I just want to make that clear, that we're not talking about simple language. Language does play a role in our culture, obviously, because if we didn't have language, you know, you wouldn't be able to even understand a word that I'm saying, right? And so we tend to think, too, that the language, the names that we give things do inherently become a part of the phenomena. But it's moreover just the identity, you know, which can be at a non-language or non-lingual level. So can we move on, or we might come back to this. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I kind of like to keep these somewhat free-form, and nonetheless, I do have an agenda. So let's move on to the very last of the four seals. We're on this sheet. Does everyone have a copy of these sheets? There's some of you that came in later that there should be some back on the table there. Again, what we're doing in this first section, this first step, is really developing, and it's good to spend more time on this, because this is really one of the key things that frames the entire rest of the Eightfold Path, the other seven steps, is really to have our right view or skillful view. How are we looking at the world? How are we relating to things? And when we looked at the four seals, we saw first this idea that everything that is kind of conditioned, created through causes, is impermanent, meaning it's changing all the time. Secondly, everything that is produced together with our ignorance, which is a part of the world that we deal with, the physical world as well as our thoughts and so on, all of those are in the nature of suffering, meaning that they're not satisfactory. They're not there in terms of taking us to our ultimate well-being. They are actually the opposite of that. Third, all phenomena are empty of self-existence. This is what we've just been talking about, that everything that exists at the deepest level lacks any sense of self-existence or intrinsic existence. Things are only established in dependence upon factors. They have no independent existence. These all lead to the final conclusion, the last axiom of all Buddhist traditions, which is that nirvana is true peace. So by nirvana, we do mean the complete removal of all of the causes of suffering, from the ignorance all the way through all the delusions that are rooted in that ignorance, all the way through the karma that has arisen through the force of that ignorance. All of that being completely disempowered and removed from the mind is what we mean by the state of nirvana, that is its final true peace. Now, by nirvana, we can talk about, going back to what I introduced last night and again earlier today, we can say there's two results, and I've talked about these before, but one of them is related to what we would call our individual path, which is the result of simply nirvana. The other one is related to the Mahayana path, the universal vehicle, and that's Buddhahood. Buddhahood is a form of nirvana too, though. I'll actually give you the term that's used for talking about nirvana in the Mahayana context. It's what we call non-abiding nirvana, meaning that you are not abiding in a sort of state of solitary peace, which is what those who practice the individual path do. They exit from this life and just kind of check out and are hanging out in this pacified state. Again, their minds being completely free of all those delusions. So you're not abiding in that, but you're also not abiding in the place where we are, which it means kind of still under the control of all these factors, still going from life to life, still involved in samsara. So Buddhas have what we call a non-abiding nirvana, meaning that they've gotten rid of all the garbage of the mind, but they still are engaged in the world from a place of enlightenment, not from a place of delusion. Whereas we're involved in the world because we're under the control of delusion, we're under the control of our ignorance. So when we say nirvana is peace, we're simply emphasizing this idea that there is a state that we can attain where we have completely removed all of our causes of suffering, and moreover the greater state of Buddhahood, where we are also fully qualified to help others to do that same work, to process that, go through that same process. So these four axioms are held by all Buddhist traditions to some degree, the third one again being interpreted in slightly different ways in different contexts, different schools of Buddhism. Any questions on those? They do again inform how we look at the world. They actually say that we do hold views that are opposite to these first three at least. We think that which is changing all the time is having some sort of permanent, lasting, unchanging identity. We also think that a lot of what we experience in the world is in the nature of pleasure and in a real way, whereas as we saw in looking at the truth of suffering, it actually isn't. And then the third one, we are obviously clinging to the opposite of that. We think everything is self-existent. Everything establishes itself. And as we went through this clothespin exercise, we see that there actually is nothing from the side of any of the parts of the clothespin that make it a clothespin. It's our own designation of clothespin that in the end establishes clothespin as existent. So it's not self-existent. It doesn't have clothespin identity from its own side. And you, the I, doesn't have identity from its own side. It's simply a way that we think of this as an I. It's helpful to even have that thought sometimes, you know, to say, oh, I'm just thinking of this as an I, and see where that leads you. There's no real I here. I'm thinking of this as an I. And that's enough for the I to exist. Oh, no, these are tricky teachings. Can we move on? Okay. So I'm just going to share one quote from Lama Yeshe in regard to the importance of understanding. And then I'm going to share another quote that kind of gets us into the movement from understanding into intention. Lama Yeshe says, Buddhism isn't some fanatical religious trip. It's a philosophical way of living life. And also, to study Buddhism, you don't need to believe in something extreme. It's a matter of investigating, examining, and experimenting on yourself. It's not just belief. Without understanding, belief can be very dangerous. So what Lord Buddha emphasized was that understanding is the path to liberation. Knowledge is the path to liberation. So that just reemphasizes why we look at this as the first of these eight steps, is because we have to begin to open up to a different way of understanding the world, different way of looking at everything that we've taken for granted is existing the way that we think it is, and begin to question that, begin to really examine that. You know, His Holiness points out how there is a very different quality to what we would call intellectual understanding versus experiential understanding. We need the first. Absolutely. You need to get some intellectual understanding of these concepts that I've tried to convey over these last few sessions. But moreover, we need to gain some experiential understanding of these teachings, which means that we need to try them on for ourselves. We need to see what it's like to look at the world through that lens rather than the lens that we've been looking at the world and looking at ourselves in the world. So from the basis of right view or understanding, we then do move on to having this awareness of our correct intention or our more skillful intention. So what I want to do to get this started is to talk a little bit about the difference between these. And this is going to be a quote from the book by Bhikkhu Bodhi that I mentioned last night, The Noble Eightfold Path. And he says, comparing these, he says, right understanding or view is more cognitive, knowing the context of the Buddha's teachings through mental investigation in order to understand the causes of suffering that are to be abandoned and to know the causes of happiness that are to be practiced. Everything we've looked at in step one was all about that. It's really helping you to know what are the causes of happiness so I can adopt them, engage in them. What are the causes of suffering, all these misconceptions and ways that we're looking at things and so on, and all of our, you know, framing of that within karma and so on. All of that, that we can then begin to understand what we need to abandon, how we need to move away from what keeps us caught up in this cycle of suffering, of dissatisfaction. And he says to move into the next topic, right intention or thought is more purposive, utilizing the information gained in the first step to create changes in our mental activity. So when we talk about intention or thought, we're really talking about this idea that this is where it begins to take shape in terms of how are we thinking in our everyday life. You know, what thoughts are going to be more beneficial? What was on the t-shirt that you guys have here now that Jill had? Think something good. It's a nice way to frame some of this, is to look at it. Buddhism is all about thinking something good. Buddhism is all about trying to take what will lead to these causes of happiness and greater well-being for ourselves and others and bring that into our minds, make that our way of actually going about living our lives. And that, of course, is going to feed into the next steps, which are how we engage with others through our more ethical behavior and so on. So let's look at the sheet. Again, you all have that sheet. We're still on that first page. Step two, right intention or thought. Having correct or skillful intention entails cultivating more wholesome attitudes and thoughts that are informed by one's correct understanding or view. So again, these aren't separate steps that you leave behind. Oh, I got step one, now I can go on to step two and forget step one. You take what you learned in step one, and it's going to inform this step, and it's going to continue to inform all of the remaining steps. Having right intention or thought includes particularly the following topics. First of all, training ourselves to think in more positive and less negative ways. Having understood the causes of happiness and of suffering, we have to make effort to change the mind, change our thoughts and intention. You know, that's easy words to say, right? Difficult to do. So it means that we are going to need additional tools to really accomplish that. Nonetheless, this should be our guiding principle. If we come to the conclusion after step one that this is our worldview, this is how we're actually looking at the world and coming to understand what is going on, then we have to make a strong intention to move in that direction, because we've seen that that is the real way to happiness. That is the real path to avoid suffering. Someone mentioned the Buddha's life story earlier, and if we look at the Buddha's life story when he was Prince Siddhartha, he was born into a royal family with everything that you would need for a very pleasurable and carefree existence. And it was said actually when he was born, he was prophesied when he was quite young as being potentially a great spiritual leader. But his father, the king, wanted to do everything to keep him in the kingdom so that he could take the kingdom after him, be in that position as king of the palace or whatever, the Shakya clan, what have you, that he could continue doing that role. And so it's actually said that his father did everything possible to keep the Buddha from realizing that life was suffering, you know, something that and even the more obvious forms of suffering we already do know. So the story is that he kept him in the palace walls primarily and surrounded him with all these delightful things, youthful-looking people and wonderful, delicious things to eat and enjoy. And eventually the prince became somewhat curious about the outside world, and he began to venture out. And so before he ventured out, though, the king had control of the whole thing and tried to make it seem as if everything outside the palace walls was just like in the palace. So the prince would become bored with it and think, well, there's no difference, so I'll just continue enjoying what I have here in the palace. So he tried to manipulate things in regard to where the prince was going to be going so that it would look just like the palace. Well, he tried, but he didn't succeed. And so the very first trip that the prince took outside of the palace walls, he saw someone who was aging. And he'd never seen an aging person before. And he says, "What is this?" And his charioteer says, "Well, this is aging. We all have to go through this." And he was shocked. You know, he had never realized, these are kind of hard for us to believe, that he wouldn't have any perspective on this idea. But this was just one step in his awareness increasing in terms of recognizing the truth that the Buddha eventually taught to everyone else, that this is part of our existence. So then he went back and he went on a second trip, and on the second trip he saw someone who was ill. In spite of everything the king did to make it appear very delicious and delightful, there was a sick person there who was ravaged by illness. And he asked his charioteer, "What is this? This is horrible." He says, "Oh, this is illness, and we all get ill at one time or another." He's like, shocked. "I can't believe this." He goes out a third time, and he happens to see a funeral procession with a corpse. You know, that somehow that appears in spite of the king's best efforts to keep the prince from seeing these sorts of things. This is the first time he's ever seen a corpse, and he goes, "What is this?" Recognizing that this is a being that no longer is as alive as everyone else. He says, "Oh, this is death, and we all have to experience death." So upon those three realities, the Buddha made a strong intention. Of course, he had a fourth trip where he actually saw a mendicant, someone who was trying to find a path to moksha, to liberation. And he decided that he needed to have that intention, right? He needed to actually set out on a path. He needed to find out why this is so. I mean, maybe some of us have, I might ask for that in a moment if any of you want to share your experiences about how you approached Buddhism. But he had this real revelation that he found this unacceptable, that beings have to age, that they have to get ill, that they have to die, and that they have to get born again, and that they have to experience with all the varieties of things in between. And he set out with the strong intention, this thought, to find the true causes of freedom from that, to achieve real peace and happiness. Does anyone want to share how they got on their own Buddhist path? If you think it's applicable to this, I'm sure it will be applicable in some way. I think, yes, Barry. Oh, yes, coming. Good. Thanks, Susan.
My wife passed away, and I had come in here just on a whim because she had mentioned meditation and that at the end. And the first time I came in, Geshe-la said that if someone dies a peaceful life, a person who loves them and very close to them will come to Buddha. And my wife, in my opinion, had died a very peaceful death because of the look on her face at the end.
Yeah.
And it just hit me that, you know, she died 2 weeks ago, and I walked in here for the first time, and he says that, and I'm like, well, you know, that makes sense that I'm supposed to be here because of that.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, Barry. I think, in fact, a lot of people do come to Buddhism with those sorts of experiences, if not exactly what you're talking about, but certainly some awakening from experiencing death and having some desire for understanding that helps one through that process or helps one transcend a sort of worldly view of what death is about. But good. Anyone else? Yeah, Susie.
When I was little, I was started as a Roman Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long story short, I was in communion class and I was probably six. And I distinctly remember thinking, when are they going to stop telling us stories? When are they going to tell us what is real?
Mm-hmm.
Every week, what's real here? And I would get frustrated. so my entire experience was like that, always thinking, okay, fine. This is whatever you want me to do, fine. And then as I grew up, I left the church. And when I came here, this made sense.
Yeah. So, again, another example of kind of an initial intention, which was to find what's real as opposed to what's a story, and that moving you in a direction of that search. Yeah.
To some people, I'm sure that story is valid. So
right,
I'm not saying
exactly.
It's a bad story.
No, no.
It just did not fulfill me in any way.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember in my Catholic years when I was quite young, I went to a Catholic grade school and high school, but in the grade school, the pastor would come in on one Friday a month or something and do a little Q&A with us. And, of course, we would ask him the most impossible questions. That's what I attribute all the impossible questions I get when I'm teaching to, is my karma from having asked my pastor all those impossible questions. But, you know, I had asked, I recall asking him once, and it was very similar to what you shared with me earlier, Susie, of it doesn't seem fair. You know, if you look at it from a Catholic point of view, which I was indoctrinated into, which is that we all have to adopt that path to end up in heaven with God and so on, that it's not a level playing field. You've got people who are never going to hear those teachings, who are blocked from hearing those, or are in situations in impoverished parts of the world and are never going to have that experience.
Or who weren't baptized but died
right
before they were baptized. Too bad.
Yeah, you know, it's like this, if this is it, your one chance, and this is salvation or not, you know, and that's the measure of it, it just didn't make sense to me. Why are we all at different positions in the race, and some of us not even able to complete it because of those conditions? It just didn't make sense. And he goes, of course, this is mysterious. We can't really know any of these things, and I don't know. So I try not to use that answer when people ask me impossible questions. But.
And coming here and understanding this gave me an understanding of how that is good for some people's minds.
Right.
And so I respect it 100% more than I used to.
But like you, I wanted to know more. You know, I wanted a deeper answer to that. And I think the teachings on karma are really instrumental in understanding that we are all at different points because we are all under the control of different factors. And, yeah, things just playing out. So, yeah.
So now that you mentioned your story and about all these different impossible questions, I remember myself in Catholic school too, in class, asking the religion teacher, why, if God is love and God is good and He is compassionate, why do we have just one chance to do things right and to be saved, right? And there was no answer, right? Because I was very puzzled about what I was receiving from them, and about thinking about reincarnation. I remember at a time I read, I was, I don't know, 14 or 15, reading a book by Brian Weiss, I think his name was, on reincarnation. It was the first time I was exposed to that idea, and it made click to me, and so I came up with those questions, and there was no answer.
Right,
and
right.
What you said, if someone is not exposed to those beliefs, then so they don't have hope. They will be condemned because they didn't have the chance to be saved by.
Right.
So that experience in my youth, in my childhood, made me go away from Catholic from the Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And then, by accident, I came here to the Kadampa Center because a friend of mine invited me to see the relics as a touristic attraction almost.
Right.
And then I got engaged and I learned about the classes, Buddhism in a Nutshell, Meditation 101, and I started coming and reading, and it has been a fascinating journey.
Great. So again, I always find it kind of interesting to see again that there are different causes and conditions that are behind all of this. And then when we finally get to a place where we begin to see something that resonates with us, then there can be, once more, going back to the subject we're talking about, this intention or thought that drives us to seek deeper understanding and deeper awareness and be committed to, again, exploring a path that we may not have grown up with but seems to resonate with us at some level. So this idea of kind of having, you know, this right thought or right intention, that first bullet point there is really the essence of it, is once we have some understanding that this is the Buddhist view and whatever drove us into this path, and many of you are at the beginning of that path, many of you have been on that path for a number of years, whatever it is that is driving you is fed by that understanding. And then an acknowledgement that with that understanding, we want to definitely change our minds to be more in accord with what will lead to happiness and what will cause us to have less and less suffering, confusion, dissatisfaction in our lives, all the way to the point of liberation and enlightenment. So the topics that I kind of included in here, I mean, that's the primary topic for when this is taught in the Theravadin tradition. The other two topics that I have in here are really the essence of what we, kind of the two main motivations that we would have in the Tibetan Buddhist presentation. Certainly the first one is common to those in the Theravadin to some degree, renunciation, and then the second one being bodhicitta, which we'll go to in a moment. I mentioned renunciation earlier. You know, renunciation in our language kind of has a strange connotation for many of us. We might think that this is meaning to be totally separate from the world, a bit of what we were talking about earlier in terms of when we see there's difficulties with objects of pleasure, that we almost have to separate ourselves from the world at large. And there may be some steps, again, in doing that to gain some sense of renunciation. But we're mostly talking about turning away from the causes that lead us to suffering. So as it says there, this is the turning away from suffering and its causes, and thus turning towards liberation, which is actually having genuine, compassionate concern for oneself. In this context, this especially means counteracting the negative states of mind, such as the three root delusions of attachment, anger, and ignorance, with the wish to eventually eliminate them in these three ways: by seeing their disadvantages, by remembering right understanding, recalling what we talked about earlier, and things being in the nature of suffering, being impermanent, and so on. And then also by utilizing what we call antidotes, both temporal and ultimate antidotes. So let's back up a little bit. I'll get to all of that in just a moment. But this whole idea of, again, renunciation is a word that we give to the state of mind when one has made that firm determination to turn away from suffering and its causes. And by suffering here, once more, we mean a broader range of experience than what we frequently call suffering in this culture. It means all of what we call conditioned existence we want to turn away from. Everything that we're experiencing that is unsatisfactory in nature, we want to move away from that and the causes of that and towards this sense of liberation. By liberation, we mean the state where, that you all can attain, every being can attain, where they have removed all of that that obscures the mind in terms of these afflictions and delusions. They haven't done the full job yet of Buddhahood, you know, attaining that state, but they can have ended their own suffering and been liberated from this wheel of existence, this going from life to life. And as I say there in that phrasing, this is really having genuine, compassionate concern for oneself. I don't like to see renunciation as being separate from compassion. It actually is a part of our development of compassion. If you really care about yourself in a very genuine way, why would you continue to create the causes of your own suffering? You know, if you don't want yourself to suffer, again, a self that is merely imputed, that's what we learned earlier, but nonetheless, a self that exists, if you don't want yourself to suffer, why would you engage in the causes of that? I mean, we know this in our own life now. Many of us, I'm sure, in the room have dealt with some sort of health problem we've had, and you gone to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, there is a way to relieve yourself of that suffering. And you didn't say, well, thank you very much, but I'm going to keep experiencing that suffering. I'm going to keep creating the causes of that and keep, you know, eating whatever it is that is bad for me or whatever, you know, you've been engaging in. Rather, we all gravitate towards freedom from suffering. Now, that's at the grossest level of suffering. That's why, once more, we have to get the range of our suffering. We have to understand that just being embodied in this way is a form of suffering. If I ask most of you right now, are you suffering, and you have just a worldly understanding of that, you probably say no. A few of you might have some aches and pains, or maybe you've had a recent loss or something going on in your life that is flavoring your experience, it to be labeled as suffering. But most of us would say, no, we're not suffering. That's why we have to understand and get the fact that just being in this existence is suffering, is unsatisfactory. Now, that doesn't, again, completely negate what I said earlier about the preciousness of this human life and the importance of using this life well. These can be embraced at the same time. This human life is important and is worth taking advantage of and using well to overcome those patterns of suffering, to actually attain a state of liberation. So I think we get this at a very basic level, that if we were to be acting in our best self-interest, have genuine compassionate concern for ourselves, we would put an end to our own suffering. We would stop engaging in what brings about suffering and turn towards freedom from that. So I actually frame, every time I talk about kind of those basic teachings that are part of our Lam Rim, our stages of the path in Tibetan Buddhism, I always frame them in terms of self-compassion. This is a big buzzword in psychology circles these days, self-compassion. I think it's because as a culture, we tend not to have much compassion for ourselves. We find it easier to have compassion for others. We think of ourselves as just maybe not worthy of that or something. But we have to initially hold ourselves as worthy of those sorts of thoughts. I mean, why not? We all fundamentally do not want to suffer and do want happiness. So let's embrace that wholeheartedly, but understand our situation correctly and understand the causes of why we're in that, and then move away from that. And this is, you know, a real way of living one's life. And then in that context, as it says, this especially means counteracting the negative states of mind, such as these three root delusions that are frequently mentioned in the Buddha's teachings: attachment, anger, and ignorance, with the wish to eventually eliminate them through these three techniques. Let's talk about these three. We've already talked about ignorance to some degree, right? Ignorance is that mind that thinks that things exist in this concrete, independent way, this self-existent way. We think there's a real I here, a real you, a real this, a real that. Now, I use that word real, as Lama Zopa Rinpoche uses it, and it's quite effective. But that's how we think of things as being real. I'm not saying when we negate that there is no I at all, or no you at all, or no nothing at all. What I'm saying by that is that the sense of reality that we think things have needs to be refuted. And this is the fundamental problem, as I said earlier, the root of all of our suffering, is this mistaken grasping at the self, grasping at the I, grasping at everything to exist in these ways. We do exist, phenomena do exist, but we don't exist in the way we think we do. So again, His Holiness's book, How to See Yourself as You Really Are, a really useful book to examine this whole process of awakening to the reality that we are involved in, which is very, very subtle. Lama Zopa Rinpoche, when he talks about emptiness, he says, it's almost as if things don't exist. It's almost as if you don't exist. You kind of like get to this very thin way that things actually exist. As I said, just nominally existent. Anything more than that is fiction, pure fiction. So this is the root of these three delusions. We often call them the three root afflictions, but this is the real root, is the root of ignorance. On the wheel of life, do you have a wheel of life in here? Just outside the door. They're usually outside the gompas. And in the wheel of life, if you look in the center, sometimes they have three animals that embody these three delusions. Ignorance, they attribute to the pig. And pigs are actually very smart animals from what I hear, so I don't know that it's an appropriate label for the pig, but sometimes they have the other two animals coming out of the mouth of the pig because they arise from our ignorance. The other two are, again, attachment and anger. Those are symbolized by the rooster, who I guess is a rather randy rooster, and then the snake, who is frequently seen as kind of something that's embodying more of those kinds of qualities of anger, hatred, what have you. It's unfortunate for those poor snakes. But so, again, you might check out that on the diagram when we have our break shortly and see those three. So from our ignorance, from our adhering to this strong sense of self, we have two responses in general. And those are responses that we have towards various feeling experiences that we have. By feeling, I mean a sort of feeling tone. Let me give you a little more description of that. So over here we can talk about, again, those things that we referred to earlier as pleasant experiences. A pleasant feeling tone. We all know this, right? It's like a nice cold drink on a hot day or whatever. It's a feeling that is very pleasurable, enjoyable. We have a feeling tone that we experience. And on the basis of that being pleasurable, we have an impulse, because we're adhering to this strong sense of I, to start grasping at that, to be attached to that, to pull that into our lives and to not want to let it go, to continue to experience it, to not let others have it. I mean, a lot of other patterns follow from this mind of attachment, but it's all this kind of grasping energy, pulling it into our sphere of experience and not wanting to be separated from it. The other feeling tone that is really diametrically opposed to this is the unpleasant one, right? And we all know this. This is, you know, maybe it getting hotter, being out in the sun after already being sweating in the shade. And, you know, you feel the heat of the sun on top of everything else. You can very quickly get a mind of this sort of aversion energy. Sometimes aversion is even used instead of anger. Anger might sound like a more heightened sense of it. But it has a whole continuum, everything from aversion to annoyance to irritation to anger to hatred to malice to, I mean, you know, you can see it can escalate in various ways. This is that tendency we have on the basis of thinking there's a solid I here that we have to defend, of pushing away that experience that is unpleasant, not wanting to be engaged in it or involved in it, and feeling this heightening sense of response to it on the basis of it being there and causing us this physical or mental pain, suffering. So we can see that, again, these are our two go-to responses to what is nice and delicious and delightful and to what is unpleasant and we want to push out of our lives. We also have neutral experiences. That's the third feeling tone. But our neutral experiences aren't such a big deal, right? Because we don't tend to react to them so much. They're not really charged in one way or another. So we have these three delusions, the ignorance that they both come from, and then these two unhealthy responses to what we get that is pleasurable and what we get that is unpleasurable. And this is why we're in the state that we're in, is because we follow these mindsets quite faithfully, too faithfully. We need to overcome them. We need to generate antidotes to them. We can say that every other delusion is an offshoot of these three. These are why these are called the root afflictions. When we look at jealousy, it's interesting. They say jealousy actually is more related to that kind of aversion or anger energy rather than attachment. But we can see how it also has some flavors of attachment sometimes. If we get jealous of what somebody else possesses, there is frequently some aversion to them having it, right? Why do they have that? They don't deserve that. But there's also maybe some level of attachment, wanting what they have. If we become really envious of their possessions or their qualities, whatever it might be. These are the main mechanisms by which we get into trouble. And so these are the three that we want to learn how to address. But of course, you can also develop antidotes to the other ones. If you find that your big one is pride, maybe pride is something that you frequently experience, feeling superior to everyone around you and so on. It might be good to work with more specific antidotes to those. But all of the delusions can be counteracted, first of all, in these three bullet points at the bottom of the page, by seeing their disadvantages. Again, that does involve some level of understanding, based on what we talked about previously, that if I follow that mind of attachment, if I follow that mind of anger, it's going to lead me down a path of creating the causes for more suffering. And it's just going to be perpetuating all the things that I don't want to experience. And that takes some level of understanding. But if we begin to examine, I think with the mind of anger, it's real easy to see that this isn't such a pleasant experience, right? I mean, is there anybody in the room who enjoys being angry? Probably, if it happens, it's a minority of people, and it's because they've simply gotten really acclimated to that it's hard for them to be without that mind of anger. That's kind of a sad place for someone to be. But if we can identify pretty quickly that anger doesn't lead to happiness, because even in the moment, we're not so happy. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of yourself or film of yourself while you were angry or yelling, but you don't look so good, right? You don't look like you're having a great time. Nobody really likes that to begin with. So we can already see even just the immediate disadvantages of that mindset. If we look at attachment, we're not so clear about seeing the immediate disadvantages. We actually think that attachment's acting in our best interest, right? It's all about that pleasurable stuff. Kind of keeps us going after that, keeps us accumulating that. I want more, I want more. We have to begin to see that that's not a healthy pattern either, that that actually is suffering, is actually a disadvantageous state to be in, to always be craving and clinging, wanting more. We can see it in these extreme things. I mean, it was Diane, I think, that brought up this whole thing around addiction. I mean, if you see people who are addicted, you can see the torment in their eyes and their minds, that they're constantly craving that substance, whatever it is that they're addicted to. You know, so we can see it at that extreme, but we have to begin to see it at even the level that we have attachment. Because I'm guessing most of you have attachment in the room. Anyone without attachment? They could learn from you. We can be without attachment, but we have to begin to address it. We have to begin to deconstruct it, to unravel it and see what it's all about. And the first step is to see that this isn't an advantageous place to be. They often use the phrase that following the mind of attachment is like drinking salt water to quench your thirst. I don't try that on a regular basis. I think you try it once and you know it's never going to work again. But this is what we're doing. We're always like going to something that actually just increases our craving mind. We just want more. I said earlier, you know, the iPhone 10 and the iPhone 11 and the iPhone 12. And we even get it with the first thing. I was really kind of shocked when the iPad went on sale in New Mexico. There's an Apple store down in Albuquerque. And they had an evening report on the news where people had lined up days in advance to buy this new product, the iPad by Apple. And they were interviewing one man and they said, you know, you're waiting to buy an iPad? And he goes, yes, I can't wait to get one. And he goes, do you know what an iPad is? And he goes, no, I don't know what it does, but I want one. You know, this is the culture that we have, right, that just wants whatever we're told to want. And some people, I'm not saying all of you, you're all good. But but this is what we're fed all the time, right, that we want something more. We want the next model. We want the improved edition. We want the better tasting, the better whatever. I mean, always wanting something more. And this does involve, again, we're talking about the dangers of pleasure. And it's not that pleasure in and of itself is the problem. It's our relationship to this, that we continually have that craving mind, continually looking for the next best thing. So we have to, you know, see that this isn't a good place to be. Any questions on that so far? Yes, Hedy.
All around. I just wanted to make a comment about self-compassion in the Western world. I'm listening. Venerable Amy was here earlier in the year, and she recommended the book A Fearless Heart by Thupten Jinpa.
Yes, yes.
And I'm reading that now. And he says he has great difficulty in the U.S. Sure. or in Western cultures getting people to practice self-compassion. Mm. And when he does compassion training, like in Asia or wherever, mm-hmm. they start with self-compassion and then work outward from there. And in the Western cultures, he says that that's just like not acceptable. Right. You know, people don't get don't understand, self-compassion as well. And they have to start, externally and then start mm-hmm. reflecting mm-hmm. it back to, mm-hmm. to self-compassion. And I just wondered if you had any observations or comments on that.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Hedy. I think that is true in my experience as well. Again, I think it is quite cultural, and it is, I think, a pretty major obstacle that we have to overcome. Because if you look at the way that the path is laid out, there is a logic to it, to really start with examining oneself and one's own situation. Master Shantideva says, how could someone who hasn't thought of that for themselves possibly think of it for others? And there is some truth to that, because I don't think you can have the full thought of wanting to enlighten all beings unless you have the thought of yourself becoming enlightened as well. But nonetheless, I think we have to use skillful means, and if it is skillful to help others to start with compassion for other beings, which I think we're quite good at in the West, admittedly, that there's a lot of people who are moved by the situation when we have natural disasters or even man-made things that go on with killings or what have you, and people opening their hearts very easily to the suffering of others that they see that are complete strangers even. But, yeah, ask them to be kind to themselves and take care of themselves, and they're maybe not so good at it. I think what we have to understand through this whole logic, though, which I think we're aware of through what we've already looked at, is that we're talking about a different way of approaching care for ourselves. I think we are good at caring for ourselves when it comes to giving ourselves all that pleasurable stuff that is like drinking the salt water, and that's not such a healthy way to care for ourselves. We have to actually care for ourselves in a deeper way by seeing that a lot of what we do for ourselves is actually not so beneficial. So we've kind of got it a little bit screwed up. When it comes to others, we're quite good at being very genuinely with them and helping them with what they need, but when it comes to ourselves, we're not always acting in our own self-interest to the best of our ability. So I think it's very true. Yes, Diane?
I'd like to suggest that some of the inability that we have, those of us who were reared in a Christian faith, is one of the things that put me on the Buddhist path, only I didn't realize that's what was happening until you kind of framed that, was when I was 7 years old, I was reared in a Lutheran church, and it was very, very negative in the liturgy and in the preaching, and I remember being told over and over and over again that I was sinful and unclean and unworthy. And if you begin your life with that premise of original sin, how could you possibly have compassion for yourself?
Well, and again, I think there are probably people in those traditions who do find an ability to have compassion for themselves, but these are the points of view that, again, can be problematic for us. That's why, once more on step one, I think that's one of the most important things, is to really focus on the teachings that reverse some of those attitudes, that get us to think about ourselves in different ways, that we are actually these beings who have incredible potential and are fundamentally pure. Our consciousness, our minds are fundamentally pure. Everything that's there that pollutes the mind is only there because we haven't counteracted it. We haven't developed what is contradictory to it. If we do that, it absolutely can be removed. And the fundamental clarity and purity of our being can be fully manifested. Take some work, but that's a different framework, you know, to work from. That's a different point to start from, rather than to say we're fundamentally flawed and we're always in this state of feeling unworthy and, yeah, it's sad that there's a lot of that that has carried over. Again, but different dispositions require different levels of teaching. Yeah. So this is the very first one of these three kind of ways that we counteract the delusions, is to see their disadvantage. That may be enough for a lot of people. Is, you know, it may really curtail your anger because you meditate frequently on what are the disadvantages of following that mind of anger. I think in the Discovering Buddhism module, it's probably the one on karma, there's a whole meditation on the disadvantages of anger. It's really useful to do to see how it is very problematic. And I would say certainly start with anger if anger is involved in your life in any way, because anger is such a destructive emotion. A bit of, again, maybe what I'm going to talk about in tomorrow morning's talk. It's not healthy for ourselves or for the world around us to be in this state of aversion, anger, you know, and so on. So seeing the disadvantages might be enough to already begin to counteract the delusions, but it doesn't go deep enough, because when various conditions arise, we might be very good at it in our everyday life, but then suddenly something really horrible happens and we don't have the wherewithal to counteract the anger at that level. So the second one is, of course, remembering right understanding. We have to recall that suffering, these unpleasant experiences, these are the nature of existence. Also that things change. I think this is so useful. I mean, a lot of people certainly have had their thoughts about having a new president and what this president might do. But the reality is that it's a changing phenomenon. It is not something cast in stone that is unchanging, but rather it's something that will continue to evolve and be very dynamic. Someone mentioned last night, you know, Rinpoche's comments on Mr. Trump and what the potential was at that time if he were to be elected, that this is really a karmic occurrence. Well, in that context, we can see that, again, it's a karmic occurrence. Karma is based on the concept of change, that things are not always going to be the same. As I mentioned last night, we can still be very influential in creating causes and conditions for other results. nothing is cast in stone when it comes to this phenomenal world that we're dealing with. So, again, having that understanding can make us less reactive to what's going on around us. We have the pleasant experience. We don't get so attached to it because we see that it's really in the nature of suffering, and it also will change. You know, that pleasant experience isn't going to last, so why should I get all crazy and grasp at it and get so attached to it, when in reality it's in the process. It's an ebb and flow. It will change and go out of my life at some point. Maybe come back into my life, go out of my life, come back into my life. I don't have to be so needy and graspy. When it comes to those that are unpleasant, I can see also that that's part of our existence. Why be so reactive? You know, this is the nature of existence. This is a product of my own past actions, my karma. It also will change. And this is a phrase that comes from the Christian tradition of, you know, this too shall pass. It's a very powerful phrase in the Buddhist tradition as well. When things are happening, just recognize that, I mean, if you've, we'll use the example of an accident, since I know there's a few people who have been in an accident. How many people have been in an accident, right? Remember what you were feeling at that time when the accident happened, and how there was so much anxiety and maybe even like, you know, hyperventilation or something. There's like a whole different experience that happens when you're there. You're not there now, right? Very different. It changed. It changed probably within a day or so. Didn't hang on to that. It's not something that lasted. So we can see that when something unpleasant comes into our field of experience, we don't have to hold it as being that, you know, static. It's actually very dynamic. And of course, as we find in the Buddha's teachings, we can also learn from those experiences. This is actually a useful way to look at anything we experience, is to see it always as a lesson for us, you know, to how we need to react more appropriately in order to create the causes for a deeper state of well-being that isn't triggered by either of these things, isn't going to go crazy when everything's wonderful and get absolutely, you know, angry and annoyed when things don't go so well. So again, having some understanding of these principles that we already talked about in right understanding can also be introduced, not just this idea of seeing the disadvantages of these states of mind, but really recalling that these experiences that we're having that are triggering those emotions are simply passing experiences that we'll have that are just part of the landscape of being in this conditioned existence. The final one is where we might spend a little more time, which is this idea of utilizing antidotes. But let's take a break, because otherwise it's already getting to 3 o'clock. Seems like the time goes really quickly here. Let's take about a five to 10 minute break, I think somewhere in there. We can give a little more time. And then we'll resume and just go till 4 o'clock. So just so you know, the kind Kadampa Center here has made some of the books that I've alluded to available in the bookstore. I actually do recommend this book very much. This is a wonderful exploration of the Eightfold Path from the perspective of a Theravadan practitioner. So it'll be not everything that I talk about, because as I said previously, I'm trying to introduce a Mahayana understanding of these as well. So not all of that's going to necessarily be in this, because this is a monk from the Theravadan tradition who has written this. Monk from Sri Lanka, I think, originally, who actually lives in West Virginia, as it says on the back. But this is, again, 8 Mindful Steps to Happiness. And then the one that I mentioned on emptiness is also there, the His Holiness's wonderful little book, How to See Yourself as You Really Are. But I don't like just throwing, again, books at people or the titles of books at people that saying, go read this, because it is important to have teachings on things as well. But books are really valuable resources, I'm sure most of you know. And we're really blessed to live in a time when there's so much available in written form in Buddhist teachings, as well as on the internet, and, you know, so many ways that we can find the Dharma. So let's resume our investigation of the very last point on that first page. The other way that we want to begin to counteract the delusions, especially these 3 poisons, these 3 root delusions of attachment, anger, and ignorance, is by utilizing these antidotes. We've actually already alluded to both of these, but it's just important that I reiterate how what we're talking about. Temporal antidotes mean that they're quite useful at the moment as a counterforce that is directly contradictory to that particular emotion. So if we look at anger, for example, certainly the mind of patience, being willing to be very patient in the face of enduring whatever it is that is going on, whatever suffering or unpleasant experience we're having, is the way to counteract that quite immediately. If we're looking at hatred at a particular person, for example, or anger towards a person, then it might be the antidote of loving kindness that I mentioned earlier. It's impossible to have a thought of hatred towards someone when we're having loving kindness. It's impossible to be angry when we are actually in a state of patience with a mind that's undisturbed. That's the whole point of the temporal antidotes. The temporal antidotes are ways that we introduce a different mindset, reframing the mind in that particular situation, to have the exact opposite of what would normally be arising. So it acts kind of against that particular delusion in a very direct way. The mind of attachment, for example, if we look at that other side, what would be a temporal antidote to that? Well, they say that there are a number of them. One of the main ones that they point out is that the mind of attachment tends to be focused only on those pleasant aspects, right? I mean, look at what happens in romantic love when people fall in love with somebody, right? They're initially, it's mostly about attachment. It's mostly like, oh, they're so delightful, their eyes are beautiful, and their voice is so melodic, and blah, blah, blah. They give all these qualities to all these things. Why do they fall out of love with that person? Because they start to see the unpleasant characteristics. Oh, they kind of smell bad every now and then. Their breath isn't so fresh. And they say that annoying thing and they click their teeth and they, whatever. I mean, all of that kind of unpleasant stuff starts to deflate all that stuff that led you to be attached to the person. And of course, we tend to then go to the mind of aversion or anger towards them then. We're totally annoyed at them because they're not what we built them up to be. Which is like really ludicrous, right? We made them into something greater than what they were, and then they don't live up to it, so there's something wrong with them. This is, both of these minds of attachment and anger are fabrications. They're superimpositions. We're putting stuff on that person that isn't there. So they say one of the most helpful ones with the mind of attachment, since we're putting so much on the person that is pleasant and enjoyable and wonderful that isn't really there, is to have a more balanced view, to kind of begin to see that this person isn't just those things, also has undesirable qualities, also has unattractive features. Not that we fall completely away from them and don't have any regard for them and want them out of our lives, but rather that we have a more balanced view. When you see things as they are in that more balanced view of having both positive and negative, you're not going to have a crazy mind of attachment. The mind of attachment can frequently be deflated by just that. But we also have other antidotes to it. Certainly, you know, we can reflect on some of the other things that we've talked about, the disadvantages of anger, that it's just feeding this desire. We can see that there's impermanence at play, that everything that we tend to put so much faith in as being a real source of pleasure wears off. It doesn't sustain that pleasure. It's not capable of doing that. Those are the main ones for attachment, though, is primarily the idea that we need to get a more balanced view. Let me go through a few of the other delusions that are not these root delusions. To pride, for example, when we have a prideful mind, it's very useful to think about all the knowledge we don't have. Here we are, maybe even we get prideful about our Dharma practice and our Dharma knowledge, but the reality is we're not enlightened yet. You know, wake up, folks. You know, you're not there yet. So what are you so prideful about? You know, you're not at that result. Just having that kind of awareness of things that we're not knowledgeable about is useful. In regard to jealousy or envy of other people, they say the antidote to that is rejoicing. We did the little limb of rejoicing as part of the seven-limb prayer before the classes today and yesterday. Rejoicing means to take delight in the good fortune of others. Usually our jealous mind is like driven crazy by other people's good fortune, right? Why do they have that? What do they do to get that? You know, we can't stand the thought that other people have good things in their life. When you see people with good things in their life, where did those good things come from? Karma, from especially their good actions, right? Again, I don't like to get into this polarization of bad or good. We can say, again, the skillful actions that they engaged in resulted in having resources in their life, having good health in their life, having good friends in their life. And rather than being envious of people having that, we should be rejoicing that they created all these virtuous causes that have led them to those positive results. So it's a very different way of looking at it. When you are rejoicing in someone else's good fortune, you can't be jealous of it. So again, that's why these are called temporal antidotes, because at the time, they disallow that delusion from arising, because they kind of immediately counteract it. Oh, I don't know if I want to go into any of the other delusions, but those are the main ones. You can certainly find a lot of resources out there that go into counteracting the delusions in this way. Ignorance is really overcome by the ultimate antidote, and all the delusions actually can be overcome by the ultimate antidote. The ultimate antidote is the wisdom realizing emptiness, particularly realizing the emptiness of the self, that if we are able to bring that awareness that we are not real in the sense that we think we are, then there's no basis upon which to have any of these faulty reactions, because there's nothing to be invested in. Again, it's not that, like, once more, going back to Peter's question, I mean, it is a tricky balance, because we do still admit that there is an I that goes on to achieve enlightenment. There is an I that goes from life to life. There is an I that experiences liberation. We can't deny that there is an I, but we won't have that level of falsehood that we're attributing to it. We won't have that extra level of, again, investment in it that is there when we have this false idea of how the I exists. When we think that there's this real I, we become extremely defensive of this I. So our ignorance, overcoming our ignorance, actually helps us to overcome all the delusions. It's the ultimate antidote, because if you're talking about attachment, or you're talking about aversion or anger, or you're talking about pride or jealousy or anything that is a distorted way of looking at things, they're all rooted in ignorance. This is, again, what the Buddha says, is that that is the root. As I mentioned, those are the roots of the tree. Everything that arises from it is contaminated with that ignorance. If you directly counteract that ignorance with this more ultimate antidote, which is the wisdom realizing emptiness or selflessness, you then can undermine any of the delusions. But for most of us, that has to be pretty strong. This is what I was mentioning to Peter earlier, is that you have to get it at a pretty deep level, I think, you know, to have that awareness of emptiness that undermines the strong sense of I clinging that causes our attachment or our aversion to arise. Most of us will probably work more with the temporal antidotes, which means reframing things at the time. When somebody unpleasant comes into our lives, to be able to look at them through the eyes of loving kindness rather than getting angry and upset at them. Or a particular political person does something that we disagree with, to see them as a suffering sentient being who deserves our compassion and love. We might still disagree with what they do, and we can do things to remedy that, but we do that within that understanding. We don't do it because we're angry and we want to do everything we can to, you know, make them suffer. We do it from a place of loving kindness. So for most of us, we're going to be, you know, counteracting the delusions by seeing their disadvantages, by remembering these truths that we've been looking at as part of our right understanding, and by utilizing temporal antidotes. But eventually we want to utilize the ultimate antidote, which will undermine all of it. Well, you know, allow us to diminish the delusions completely. So again, renunciation, this is what we've been looking at, is the mind that is intent upon doing this type of work. The mind that says, I have had it up to here with suffering and its causes, and I'm going to do everything I can to be rid of them and to move towards liberation, towards freedom from that. And so renunciation is an active process. It's not just a single state of mind that we get to and then we live there. It means that you actually apply renunciation to your life. You are renouncing the causes of suffering. You're not renouncing pleasure. You're not renouncing, you know, anything else. You're really renouncing what are within ourselves, the causes of our own grief and suffering. So any questions on renunciation? Let's go on to the other motivation or intention that is really useful for us in this Mahayana tradition, which is on the next page at the top. Yay, we're on page 2.
Sorry, not so fast.
Okay, Hedy. Sorry.
Well, when people talk about attachment, they talk about attachment to people primarily. And yet a lot of our attachments aren't to people, they're to things.
Mm-hmm.
Or activities, you know,
sure.
Playing a game. Well, you hear about teenage boys being addicted to you know,
video games
and that sort of thing. And you know, causes, you know, similar sorts of problems, but mm-hmm. it's the antidote doesn't seem like...
Yeah, like seeing the unfavorable or unattractive things about that doesn't seem to match up with
that. Right.
I think it still can, because we can see, you know, again, that if we spend all this time, and maybe for young people who feel like they've got lots of time and they don't have to worry about, you know, things quite yet, they might feel quite innocent in their playing video games. But if we look at ourselves and we see how we are spending our time and becoming attached to various activities, various things in our lives, we can see that there's something unattractive about that, because it essentially is taking some of those precious grains of sand that we don't know how many we have. There's like an upper chamber of all the moments we have left in this life that are continually going through that little hole down into the lower chamber, which are all the moments that have already gone from this life. And we're, in a sense, wasting those. I mean, there is an unattractive aspect to those, because it's really not the best use of this life. It's not the best way to, you know, make this life purposeful and meaningful. So there is that side that we can look at. But maybe, again, in some of these situations, we have to look at some of the other ways that we're combating them. For example, to see the disadvantages of that. That if I kind of continue to do these things, play these games, whatever, I just strengthen that tendency. I mean, why are people so addicted to these sorts of things? Because they've modeled that pattern of addiction. They've gone again and again to those things. I mean, a lot of people in our culture have an unhealthy relationship with food, right? And they look at food as just something that they're continually going to fill that neediness, that desire that they have for something pleasurable in their lives. And it can be a very unhealthy pattern to get into. So we can see that from the point of view of this is not something that is that attractive, because if we continue to do that, we endanger our own health and potentially lose this life before we have a chance to use it well. And we can also see that this is not a healthy pattern to get into, where we have an unhealthy relationship with food, because it will compound upon itself and potentially create a lot more difficulty in our lives. So I don't know. I mean, I think that each of these we might need to find a particular way that we can get in there and find something to undo that pattern, at least even for a few moments, so that we can think about it before we do it and maybe try to have a slightly different mind, you know, while we're eating or whatever the case might be. But to recognize when these patterns are coming up that there are some disadvantageous sides to all of these, certainly. And there can even be a bit of that unattractive features to that. I mean, let's go back to the chocolate cake, right? You know, if I brought a big piece of chocolate cake in here, it might look really delicious, but let's pick apart what's really in there. And now they give us all the nutrition facts, right? You know, so we can say how many grams of fat are actually there, that are saturated fat, that are maybe not so good for our bodies. We can see that it might look really pleasant and delicious and wonderful, but there's a lot of stuff in there that is not so attractive when it comes down to it, in terms of just the health of this body. Well, I'm not saying that that should be the measure of our Buddhist practice, that we're always simply concerned about the health of our body, for example, but we do have to be concerned about this life and using this life well. So if we see that there are some unattractive aspects to those things even that we can apply at the time, maybe we can say, I'll take a half a piece, or maybe I won't have cake at all, or whatever the case might be. I mean, they do go so far in some teachings to say, this might sound kind of gross, but the food that you're putting in your mouth, think about what it looks like on the other end. I mean, it is the same food you ate. It's just gone through a process of digestion and removal of all the nutrients and whatever. And I mean, we are these machines that basically take all this delicious-looking stuff and turn it into caca, you know. That's really what's going on. I mean, that may be one way to undermine for some folks. Some people may not find that the most useful one. I don't know. These are just some suggestions. I'm sure these guys back here don't play a lot of video games, do you? Do you play video games? No. Yeah. No, and again, one of the things I want to reemphasize, because we're talking about pleasure and any of these sorts of pleasurable experiences, is that the pleasure isn't the problem. It's your relationship to it. And there's nothing wrong with saying, I need at some point to just have some downtime where I'm just experiencing that pleasure and just being refreshed by it to some degree. You know, you watch a movie or you go to the theater, whatever, and you have some experience that lightens your mind a bit. But do it with a motivation that wants to make good use of that time even. That's a bit of what we're talking about with both renunciation and bodhicitta, is this idea that you can bring a thought or an intention into that action that flavors the action in a different way. Let's just, we just had lunch not that long ago. If you look at the whole thing of eating food, well, why do you eat food? I mean, just think about that when you sit down to eat food. Why am I eating food? If it's just coming from a place of, oh, because I'm hungry and I can't wait to, you know, dig my teeth into that stuff, well, that's a pretty basic way, and that's how animals eat, right? You can bring more thoughts to that action. You can say, I'm going to eat to sustain this body, to be able to continue my spiritual path, to develop a deeper sense of renunciation, to see that what I'm involved in is actually a cycle of suffering, of dukkha, and to want to benefit other beings through generating this intention of bodhicitta. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche is very keen on this, bringing this thought, what we call bodhicitta mindfulness, bringing it into even our most mundane activities. I was during the break mentioning to somebody it's in this book that's out here in the free, I'm sure you've got copies of Bodhisattva Attitude, right? Yeah. One of the free books from Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive. And he goes through an explanation of many of these types of things. It even gives you practices to do when you're sitting on the toilet. Yeah. Engaged in that process we were just talking about earlier. What happens to the food when it comes out the other end, you know? You can have a different thought about that. You might think, well, this is crazy. Why should I think something different about that? It is what it is. But your thoughts are important. That's the whole purpose of looking at this second step, is what you bring to your actions is important. If you're simply thinking about more delusion, more attachment, more craziness, well, guess what? That's going to keep you in patterns that lead to more suffering. If you start thinking about others, you start thinking about generating your own desire to be free from suffering. That has an impact on your life. Because everything starts with the mind. That was the first topic we looked at, right? Good. Does that help a little bit? Yes, Sana.
I just loved your phraseology. Why should we think differently about it? Because it is what it is. It isn't what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is really kind of a measure to some degree. We do tend to put a lot of labels on things and think about them as being that, you know. But, yeah, it isn't really what it is. The microphone for Andre. Yeah.
Talking about renunciation, I was thinking about the book by Lama Yeshe, When the Chocolate Runs Out.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it's a really neat little book, you know. Uh-huh. But you know, he said the problem that we have is that we think renunciation means to get rid of everything,
sure,
right? Get rid of our stuff. And as you were saying, stuff isn't the problem. It's our relationship to the
sure
stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's our attachment to the stuff. And that's what we have to renounce, you know.
Exactly.
Not this, he says, go ahead and have your whatever it is that you really, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a big deal. And I find so many people, they think, well, you know, I can't do this. I can't get rid of my, you know, my flat screen TV. I can't get rid of, or even, you know, or they think, well, it's something, I shouldn't even watch TV and so forth.
Right.
It's not the problem. It's the mind that's associated with that. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. And I was reminded of, even when I was teaching one of the prisons, I go to a prison in Santa Rosa, New Mexico, and one guy who showed up many years ago, when I started talking about some of these ideas, I mean, he was taking it, he couldn't hear it, but through that lens of, this means I can't listen to my music, I can't do this, I can't do that. And I was like, well, no, that's not what it means. But I think it's hard for us because we tend to think it's all or nothing. It's like, either I have to be completely removed from it or I'm totally caught up in it. But there is a middle way. Again, there's a way to kind of be in the world but not get sucked up into the same patterns. But it does take some skill and ability to do that. So we have to just keep doing the practice. Yeah, Barry.
Yeah. Recently, I don't know, the last 8 months, I've gone just the opposite of protecting myself from everything that's going on.
Uh-huh.
So I don't pick up a newspaper. I don't turn on a radio.
Yeah.
I don't watch TV. So I guess maybe I need to go to the middle way. But right now, I don't feel like that's beneficial to me. So I don't do it. I don't watch it. I don't want to know about it. If I sit down and I have a free minute, I'll put on YouTube, I'll put on a teacher, I'll listen to something that's beneficial to my mind rather than put on the news, because I know what's going on out there. And if I want to see suffering, I go down to the mission and help those guys eat dinner once a week. And I look at 176 faces feeding them, I see suffering. So I don't need the TV. But I'm just saying, I don't know if I'm
no, you're doing it
if
right.
I'm over the, overdoing it.
No.
But at this moment, I don't feel like it's good for my mind to be wasting my mind and letting all this other negative stuff come in when I have so much to work on.
Right. I think you're doing perfectly with it, because if we say what is the job, and going back to that idea of what is our intention here, we could condense what this says in terms of thinking in more positive and less negative ways as being encapsulated in the idea of we need to protect our minds. How do we protect our minds? Sometimes it does mean that we have to cut ourselves off from the other things that are disturbing our minds, because those will be an impetus for us to go to those habitual states. There are other times when, due to our force of our work, we can be out with the suffering, we can be out with some of the challenges, and find that to actually be a boon to our practice. But it's our job to protect our minds. So if you're protecting your mind by doing that and making good spiritual practice out of it, congratulations, you're doing what you need to be doing. And And I think this is the thing, is each of us are going to be at a different place, and each of us are going to hear these teachings and think, oh, this is what I need to do from here. And it will be unique to you in terms of what you feel you need to do to practice these teachings. And there's no right answer to it in that regard, because we're all works in progress, and we're all going to be at different stages of knowing what it is that we need to adopt, what it is that we need to discard, and just finding that balance for ourselves. I think that's where we're actually using our wisdom and having real compassion for ourselves, and of course for others as well. You know, we don't need another person angered at the world situation walking around being angry with everyone else, you know. That's just No, I think you're making a perfectly valid way of practicing by doing that. It's a good point. Okay, let's talk a little bit about bodhicitta. So bodhicitta, again, is the other one that I added to this list under correct thought or intention, because it's so essential in practicing our Mahayana path. So having looked at right understanding in terms of, you know, having this worldview about what the Buddha taught and the Four Noble Truths and so on, what we're doing with bodhicitta is we're understanding that all beings are in the same process. All beings are involved in the same thing. And in essence, there is no difference between myself and others. And in fact, I mean, if there's any difference, it's the fact that there are many of you that are others, and there's only one of me that's myself. And so this is the whole idea that we touched on a little bit last night. Even someone mentioned that this is, Rashad from the Book of Joy, that this is a real principle that's emphasized in both His Holiness and Archbishop Desmond Tutu's talking in that book about we genuinely find our own deepest happiness when we are dedicated to the welfare of others. Of course, it takes some convincing at some level for us to get there, but if we actually look at most of the experiences we've had in our lives that are quite joyful and beneficial for ourselves, they are also ones where we've been dedicated to the welfare of others, where we've been deeply involved in concern for other beings. So this is bodhicitta itself. We mentioned this word before. Citta is mind. Bodhi is awaken. Sometimes citta is translated as heart. There's nothing wrong with that translation. This is the mind of awakening, the awakening heart. It is defined as the aspiration to attain enlightenment for the welfare of all sentient beings. You know, so this is, again, enlarging our concern to include all beings. It doesn't mean that you're left out. It doesn't mean that, you know, your self-compassion is totally ignored now. It means that you're taking that compassion you've generated for yourself through genuine renunciation and enlarging it to say, and I also want everyone else to be free from suffering. I also want everyone else to be happy. And become dedicated to a path that leads to your being able to be capable to do that at your greatest level, which is this goal of enlightenment. You know, so the mind of enlightenment is the mind that is primarily striving to benefit others and recognizing that you have to become enlightened to do that. I often compare this to, say there was somebody who grew up being around relatives, maybe even parents or something, that died of cancer. And one becomes very moved by this and wants to do something to alleviate cancer in the world and the people who suffer from cancer. So maybe at like a very young age, you're in grade school, you know, you're 12 years old, and you've been affected by cancer in your life by these people all suffering from it, dying from it, and you make the determination that you want to do that. Well, are you ready at 12 years old in grade school to be serving people with cancer and helping them to be free of their cancer? You know, you can have that thought, but you can't do much. You're not capable yet. You haven't finished your education. You haven't gotten medical knowledge. You haven't, you know, developed all the skills and abilities to be able to become a doctor of oncology or whatever, the, you know, researcher into cancer. You haven't done all that work to get you to that level. So what drives you is you want to be benefiting those people. But what drives you to go to medical school and even grade school and high school and engage well in all your studies is because you want to benefit others. And you realize that you have to become more capable to benefit others. That's a very similar thing with bodhicitta. It's recognizing that you want to be, you know, concerned for other beings and their suffering. You want to help them to have true happiness and peace. Well, can we do that now? Are any of us capable of really helping someone to be completely free from their suffering and achieve complete welfare and happiness? I mean, I'm not. I don't think any of us in the room are at that level of capability. So we need to get capable. We need to become more capable. Becoming a Buddha means becoming more capable. When you attain Buddhahood, I mentioned this earlier, you have completely removed everything that obscures your mind, meaning that the mind is there in its complete pristine purity, but also imbued with all the qualities that we've developed on the path, all of our compassion, all of our wisdom, all of that knowledge, motivated to benefit others. And it said that it's not only the sort of mental state, it is the ability that one has then to manifest in whatever way can be useful for others. So this is why they say Buddhas can appear in any way. I kind of joke sometimes that you all could be Buddhas to help me to get enlightened. You're just appearing here as students, you know, and nodding your heads and taking notes and doing whatever so that I can get enlightened. And I'm sorry it's taking me so long, but you keep doing what you're doing. But I don't know. No one knows how Buddhas are appearing in the world. Buddhas could be appearing as some homeless person on the street. Buddhas could be appearing as the people where Barry goes to help, you know, the homeless at the homeless shelter. We don't know where people are, or where Buddhas are appearing as people or as inanimate objects. They say Buddhas can appear in whatever form is beneficial for others. The job then of a Buddha, as I mentioned previously, is to enlighten all beings through whatever means is possible. From the side of Buddhas, that's what they're doing. The side of sentient beings, they will experience it in accord with their own karma. I mean, if we look at the Buddha's own life story, after he became enlightened, he had a cousin. Many of you know of this cousin named Devadatta. Devadatta hated the Buddha. He was envious of the Buddha. He did everything he could to stop the Buddha. He even tried to kill the Buddha. And you're kind of like, my gosh, you know, this is a Buddha. This is an enlightened being who's already shown that, demonstrated that, has all those qualities, has all these followers, started the whole ordained community and all of this, began teaching the Dharma. And still there are beings who don't have the karma to see that as a Buddha, who see that as somebody that they despise and want to, you know, do everything to stop. So even in the case of the Buddha appearing in that form, there were still people who didn't have the karma to see the Buddha in that way. And here we are, much more obscured, at least I can speak for myself, much more obscured. We don't have the ability to see the Buddha in such a pure form. Yeah. So we just keep working on removing more and more of our own impurities and eventually having greater and greater access to the Buddha's enlightened activities in the world. And by Buddhas, I mean the plural Buddhas. There are countless Buddhas out there. There are beings who were just like us who, again, have attained that state, and they're fully dedicated to achieving the welfare of ourselves and all beings. So this is kind of bring it full circle. We right now are generating a mind, an intention, a thought to benefit others by becoming a Buddha, and it will come full circle because when we attain that state, we will actually be able to help others. Helping them in accord with their karma. Helping them as best as we can, because there's no fault from the side of the Buddhas. The fault is really from the side of sentient beings in terms of what they can experience in terms of the benefits from the Buddhas, from their enlightened activities. So any questions on that idea? Yeah, Susie?
How can the Buddhas help us? I understand you just mentioned our karma,
mm-hmm.
what we can see.
Sure.
And I believe I've heard something about they can't do things for us, meaning they can't take away our karma or say, don't do that. Or, how can they help us?
Okay.
What's the limits? It's a thought thing.
I mean, we can obviously say that the Buddhas can't enlighten us like that because they would have done it. I mean, there's proof right there, because if you talk about somebody who has this level of compassion that we are about generating in this path, we're going to talk about compassion and love in just a second, but if you have that level of compassion that you cannot bear to see sentient beings suffer, then, and you had the ability to enlighten them, why wouldn't you do it? Right? There's no rationale there. I mean, it's the same logic I used to use around God in the Catholic tradition, is like, if God's a compassionate God, well then why does he allow suffering to happen? And still, many people who adhere to a tradition of a creator God ask that same question, because they do see the source of their happiness or suffering coming from a God, and they would wonder why such a compassionate God would do that. If the Buddha is so compassionate, if this enlightened beings are so compassionate and they could enlighten us, it'd be cruel for them to hold that back and to not enlighten us. Right? So what can a Buddha do? Not that. And they actually do say, there's one phrase from the Sutras of the Buddha that says, Buddhas do not remove the suffering of others like you would pull a thorn out of a hand. They also don't wash away all of our negativities like you would remove dirt from a cloth. They also can't take all their realizations in their own mind and plant them in our minds. So how do the Buddhas help sentient beings? By teaching the Dharma. You know, so we don't want to say that that's the only way that they benefit others, but that is the principal way. Why? Because by Buddhas continually turning the wheel of Dharma, by continually giving us teachings, they are giving us the medicine that we need to take to relieve our suffering, to actually be free of all of that. But again, the forms that they will appear in to do that can be varied. Nonetheless, we have in this tradition certainly the concept that if we go looking for where are embodied Buddhas at, where would you find embodied Buddhas? Sure, you can find them in any form. They can be anyone that we meet on the street. But where are they most likely to be if their main activity for alleviating the suffering of sentient beings is to teach Dharma? Well, then where are they? They're teaching Dharma. They're our Dharma teachers, particularly what we call our gurus, our lamas. So in this tradition, many people, and in the traditional Lam Rim teachings, one of the other preliminary topics besides perfect human rebirth is reliance upon the spiritual guide. By that we mean someone who we have made a commitment to as our guru, who we would ideally want to see as the Buddhas in our lives, giving us the Dharma that we need. And if they are enlightened beings, which we would hope that they are, then they're giving us Dharma exactly in accord with what we need. They know our minds and know exactly what to say, because they are just a mirror for where we're at, and they will give us exactly the teachings that we need at any particular time, exactly according to our karma. This is the view that we hold in this tradition, is that people like His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, other great holy beings, and some of you might even have that view of one or more of your Geshes here. It's not impossible to have that view of other teachers. They don't have to be at that high a level. A guru can be anyone who we choose to see through that lens of being a very important teacher in our lives.
It could be somebody we bump into at the supermarket maybe just once. Could be giving us an example or something.
Could be. We don't know.
And you said that Buddhas can be in many forms. So they could be a thing or an animal.
Absolutely. If there's a benefit to sentient beings by appearing in that way, then they will appear in that way. They don't do it for kicks, like, you know, oh, let me show up as a muskrat and see what happens. Yeah. Buddhas are solely motivated by benefiting beings. So if it's helpful for a muskrat to be there at that time, to divert someone's attention to something that will help them to not suffer, then maybe, you know, that's what the Buddhas will do. But again, you have to also have the karma to have the Buddha appear as a muskrat and do that for you. It is karmically conditioned. If it wasn't karmically conditioned, then you wouldn't have me in front of you. You'd have Buddhas in magnificent forms with light bodies, you know, giving the Dharma exactly in accord with what you need to hear, rather than me going blah, 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 and hoping that what I say hits home. I have no idea if what I'm saying is hitting home or not, other than maybe occasional nodding heads or what have you. But I don't know your minds. A Buddha would know your mind and would be able to speak to each of you and give you exactly what you need to hear.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Thanks for that question, Susie. So again, what we're talking about in terms of the goal is aspiring to achieve that level of being able to benefit others. It's pretty profound. You know, if we want to compare, we were doing comparisons of the soul in Buddhism, you know, to the mind. Are these things the same, what have you? If we talked really about what we mean by God in many of these other spiritual traditions, I think Buddha comes pretty close to it. But the difference that I hear from my own experience is that Buddha is not something that is unattainable in the sense that God is for many spiritual traditions. Many spiritual traditions, there's a gulf, a divide between what we call the divine and what we call human, or, you know, worldly. In Buddhism, worldly is on the process to eventually becoming what is sacred, what is divine. We are all in the same continuum. The Buddha was just like us. The Buddha was a suffering being, tormented by their mind and craziness and what have you, in the same way that we are. The only difference is the Buddha's done the work to get to that result. If we want to get to that result, we have to do the work. And the first movement in that direction is bodhicitta, is the mind that says, I am going to aspire to achieve that goal. I want to become a Buddha. And so we should frequently think about what it means to be a Buddha, because it greatly influences our desire to achieve that state. I mean, how magnificent it would be to be able to be of that level of benefit to others. Because you're not out of the picture at all then. It's not like you continue to suffer while you're dedicated to everyone else's welfare. You will attain your greatest potential, your greatest state of well-being. You'll be blissed out, they say. I have no idea. But, you know, you'll just be in this unparalleled state of being. And there is a magnificent resource for all beings. I mean, how incredible. So this mind is especially rooted in cultivating the following. It says, great compassion and great love. You can see these as kind of two very complementary thoughts. Compassion is motivated by seeing the suffering of others and wanting to, you know, for them to be free from that. Great compassion is when we say, I will be the agent to free them from that. Great love is looking at the lack of happiness that others have, their quest for happiness, and wanting them to be genuinely happy. And moreover, great love is that thought, I will do that for them. I will place them in happiness. And of course, Buddhas are placing beings in states free from suffering and in true happiness by teaching the Dharma. As I mentioned earlier, that's the real main enlightened activity that they engage in, appearing to beings and giving them the exact instruction that they need. So great compassion and great love are practiced as a fundamental part of the Mahayana path. Compassion and love are practiced by all Buddhist traditions. Many of you know of what are called the four immeasurable thoughts. These are practiced in the Theravadan tradition as well as the Mahayana traditions, and they really are a fundamental part of the Buddha's philosophy of what we call ahimsa, or non-harmfulness. Non-harmfulness means that we are connected with others, and we should have a mind that not only doesn't want ourselves to experience harm, but we should also not want to have others experience harm. We should only want well-being for them. So all traditions of Buddhism, and we can say even in most spiritual traditions, there's some practice of compassion and love. Again, the idea, though, is the difference in this Mahayana motivation is the thought, I will be the agent of helping beings not suffer. I will be the agent of helping them to have happiness. And I think that is a pretty tall order. I remember when I was first, he died when he was 70, and he was ill for quite a number of years, and there's a particular practice in Tibetan Buddhism called Tonglen, which is a very powerful method of working with compassion and loving kindness by visualizing taking away the suffering of others and giving them happiness, which is contrary to how we normally think, right? We normally think, well, I want all the happiness for myself. You can take all the suffering. Thank you very much. So this is a really powerful way to work with this. And my mother was kind of one of the instruments in helping this to happen. She said, well, Don, you've practiced meditation. Maybe, you know, that would be useful for, you know, Dad. And I said, well, it's up to Dad. Does he want to do any meditation? And he said, oh, sure, I'll try some meditation. And so I thought, you know, this is a pretty tall order to get someone to practice even any level of Tonglen, but I thought it'd be useful for him to think about others who were suffering at that time. You know, when people are in a state of distress, it's very easy to get quite narrowly focused on oneself. And this is actually a source of greater pain for us if we look at it. If you start thinking about the suffering that others are going through and thinking how wonderful it would be if, even through my own suffering, if they could be free from that. Or what measure of happiness I do have, wouldn't it be wonderful if those people who are in distress were to have that experience? So I introduced this meditation to him, and we did it. And at the end of it, my father goes, well, it was interesting, but he says, I'm not sure I get why I want to do that. And I said to my father, well, don't you want to have the level of compassion that Christ had for everyone? Because, you know, with his Catholic upbringing. And he said, I can't possibly do that. He saw that as an impossibility, that is not in the domain of his ability. He couldn't reach that far. And he saw it again as that is the domain of God, whereas being involved at this sort of worldly level is our domain, and there's a gulf between those two. And so I think that this is a real difference in terms of what we mean by compassion and love in our culture are really advanced to a much greater degree in this Mahayana tradition. And it does take that level of wanting to be the agent, the instrument to protect others from suffering and to bring them to happiness that is involved in bodhicitta. So just to have that awareness, this isn't a topic I'm going to spend a whole lot more time on, but just to know that we are talking about advancing those to a pretty high degree of personal responsibility, saying this is our job to relieve the suffering of others, to bring them to happiness. And it means we can do things like helping serve meals or whatever the case might be to people who are in need. But it also means that we dedicate every moment of our life to full awakening, to achieving that state. This is why I was mentioning earlier these bodhicitta mindfulness exercises, where we can actually think about opening a door and changing our mind when we're opening that door. We've got some of the wonderful labels out here, the posters on doors and what have you, so that people bring those things to mind when they open or close a door. You know, it's a thought technique to train our minds to think this way more and more and more, till you get to be someone like Lama Zopa, you know, where every thought that you have is about others. I don't think there's a selfish bone in Lama Zopa's body. I mean, I don't think he has any thought of, oh, I've had enough of all you students. I need to go chill out and binge watch on Netflix or something. I mean, he doesn't have any of that level of self-concern in terms of he sees his needs being met completely when he's with others. He's solely focused on the welfare of others. We can see that being mirrored in our teachers and aspire to accomplish that. So any questions about bodhicitta? It's a big topic that I didn't go into in maybe enough detail. Just know that in this Mahayana tradition, in the Lam Rim, which I use that word frequently, it's two words. Lam means path, Rim means stages. So it's the stages of the path teachings. The techniques for generating bodhicitta are taught extensively. Tonglen is included in one of those techniques. The very powerful ways to begin to open our heart, going back to that idea of heart-mind being interchangeable at that level, to really having this aspiration of being of greatest benefit to others. Okay, let's go on. I think I've talked enough about that. Let's go on to talk a little bit about what we're moving into now. So we go back to the introductory sheet, again, that all of you have, the colored sheet. We've looked at the two that are the main topics in this sort of skillful or correct or right wisdom. Again, we come back around to that because, as I said, this is a circle. And so we will see that what we look at from here on out is influenced by what we've already examined, but also influences our deeper wisdom, our deeper understanding. So the next section that we go into is the higher training of morality. As I mentioned earlier, there are three categories in this, three trainings, if you will, three paths. The first is right speech. The next is right action. So these are the other two doors that I mentioned, the three doors being our mind, our speech, our bodies. So those are the three ways that we kind of manifest some level of activity, and that is the principal mechanism by which we have karmic effects, is what we do with our minds, our thoughts, which we've already talked about in right intention, how we speak and engage in verbal communication, as well as even other forms of communication with others, and then how we are physically in the world, which includes the third one to some degree, which also is a part of our speech, our livelihood and how we are going about living. I'm even going to do a special class here. Is that Wednesday night, I think, on using work as a spiritual path, where we'll talk a little bit more about dimensions of whatever your occupation is, how you bring some awareness of what you want to be doing, depending upon what's happening in your work life, of how to make it into a spiritual path. But these are the three that the Buddha pointed out that are important to support everything that we've learned in right understanding. So if we have and right intention for that matter, if we have this level, this foundation of wisdom, how do we then go about being in the world? Because these three are really more about that manifestation that we have with others, when we're speaking with others, when we're acting with them, when we are working with them and engaged in some form of livelihood. So this is where we really begin to move more into the teachings on karma. And I thought before we actually get into right speech, which is the first of these three, is to really talk a little bit more about karma. So I talked about karma initially as part of our worldview, as the first of these eight steps, is to really have a correct understanding of the principle of karma. And I think it's important if we advance that as we get into these individual steps involved in the second grouping around morality, that we look at what are called the four general characteristics of karma. I think it's really useful to have an underpinning and understanding of those, because they are the way that we can begin to get our heads around how karma works. I mentioned it earlier, it's just a simple law of cause and effect, that the actions that we do through body, speech, and mind plant seeds, and those give rise to results further down the road. So these four general characteristics explain a bit about how that happens. The very first one, and I apologize, many of you in the room have heard these teachings before, but as I was told, Dagri Rinpoche, who came through the master's program where I studied, he came through on one of the times when I was actually away, but he told the people who were there, many of them like myself, wanting to become Dharma teachers, that being a Dharma teacher isn't like being a news anchor person, you know, where every night you go, oh, today in the news there was this and that, and giving people something new. Being a Dharma teacher is saying the same thing over and over and over again. So, anyway, that's the warning for those of you who've heard this teaching before. Try to listen to it with beginner's ears. Try to actually, you know, see what you can hear that might be different from your own understanding. The very first of these four general characteristics is that karma is definite or certain. And what we mean by that is, we'll use the analogy of in nature, you know, we see that trees arise from seeds, right? So if we plant a seed that is an apple seed, do you get an avocado tree from it? No. You get an apple tree from an apple seed, given, of course, all the right conditions that are necessary for that to grow into an apple tree. I mean, we'd be shocked if we took something as small as an apple seed and put it in the ground and an avocado tree came up, right? We go, where did that come from? Because you know that the seed of an avocado is substantially larger than an apple seed. So you know you didn't plant that. You know you planted something very tiny, you know, but you got an apple tree. So this is what we mean by karma is certain or definite. If you plant a positive seed, a skillful seed, what do you get? You get a result of happiness. You don't get a result of what we call pain or, you know, that level of suffering. You get something that we are calling a pleasurable experience, a happy experience, a good experience, a wholesome experience. It's in line with it because it's definite or certain. On the other hand, if you plant something that is unskillful, that is negative, that is not constructive and beneficial, it will only give rise to pain, to difficulty, to problems, to suffering in that way. Okay? So it's very definite. Sometimes it looks like it's a little opposite, right? let's say, you know, somebody who goes in to rob a bank and they actually steal all that money from the bank and they get away with it. They go off to Mexico and they live the rest of their lives with these resources they stole from the bank that will go much further in Mexico because everything will cost a little less. So they live a relatively pain-free life from having stolen money. Does that mean that this law doesn't apply? That from something that was negative, they actually got a positive result? They were actually able to live out the rest of their lives in relative comfort and safety? What the Buddha would say is you have two different things going on. That living out one's life with all of that money and getting away with the money was due to a positive karma, some generosity they engaged in the past that ripened into them having those resources come into their lives. But they came about through an unskillful way, which planted the seed that's going to bring about an unfortunate circumstance in the future for them. Karma does take time for it to ripen. It's not an immediate phenomenon. John Lennon sang about instant karma, right? But there's no instant karma in that way. If we engage in an unskillful action, sometimes the results might look very positive in the moment. We might get away with that. We lie to somebody and we get the contract for that, you know, business deal. Well, you lied in the process of creating that fruition of that karma. You get that positive fruition that came from something positive you did, but you're going to suffer the negative consequences further down the pike. The second principle of karma is a bit like that apple seed, too. When we plant an apple seed, again, it's very tiny, pretty minuscule. But what do you get from an apple seed, given that all the conditions are there for it to grow and develop? A whole apple tree and all the bushels of apples that come from it over time, as long as flowers aren't killed by frost, which happens in New Mexico a lot to the apple trees there. Anyway, the idea is that given all of this, you know, amazing fruition, it all starts from something that is quite small. There's an element of expansion involved there, an increase. What was starting out quite small actually became quite large. Well, they say that the expansion that occurs with karma, because the second principle or characteristic is that karma expands, that expansion is much greater than what you see in the physical world. That little tiny seed that grows into the apple tree and all the bushels of apples is nothing compared to the way that karma expands. And karma expands kind of exponentially over time. They say, like, over the course of one day you've done that one action, it doubles for the next day, and then that doubles for the next day, and that doubles for the next day. So you end up with a very, very vast and powerful result coming from something that is very, very small and seemingly insignificant. So this principle is to help us to begin to pay attention to the reality that everything positive that we plant, no matter how small, can ripen into unbelievable results. Everything negative that we plant, no matter how small, can actually ripen to great, painful, difficult, suffering results. So we have to pay attention to this idea that things are, you know, not linear. And that's why our understanding of karma in the West is a little skewed. We always have that idea of, like, the boomerang that we just kind of throw and it comes back around, and it's the same boomerang. It just, like, hits us with a similar type of result. We lie to somebody and then it comes back around and someone lies to us. Well, it's much more complex than that. There are varied results because karma is increasing. The whole time it's going around, it's becoming much bigger than that one action. And it has these amazing results that are far beyond that one action that we did. Well, it's hard for us to get our heads around. But it's just a natural law. Everyone asks, well, why does it happen that way? Well, don't know. It's just the way it is. Why is when you plant an apple seed and all the conditions there, it grows into an apple tree? It's just nature. It's just the nature of that apple seed. Any questions on those two so far? Okay, the last two can kind of be seen as corollaries to each other. The third is that you don't experience results that you haven't created the causes for. The fourth one is you do experience the results from karma that you have created, actions you have done. Or we could say in shorthand, actions done are not wasted. So what these mean is that if we want to experience a particular result, or if we don't want to experience a particular result, then we have to pay an awful lot of attention to the causes we're creating. Because we won't get the results from actions we haven't done, and we will experience the results from the actions that we have. Sounds rather simplistic, but this is, again, the way that karma works. Nothing is wasted. every single moment we are creating some subtle karma, or maybe not creating incredibly powerful karma, but we are creating movement of the mind in particular directions, and then frequently movement of our mouth in particular directions through our speech, movement of our bodies through our physical actions. So all of this is part of the mechanism of karma. Now, the last one, the fourth one, I do want to mention that we could put like a little footnote to that one. Actions done are not wasted, footnote, unless they are interrupted. Now, how do we interrupt negative actions? Anyone in the room? Purification. Purification is taught in Buddhism as a tool that you do yourself. It's not like when I was growing up in Catholic, I'd go to the priest for confession, right? And I'd need to be absolved by somebody outside of myself who heard my sins and knew that my contrition was trite and true and whatever, you know. And so anyway, all that idea, you know, that I have to seek my forgiveness outside of myself. I have to resolve that and purify that by looking at something outside myself. The practice of purification is done entirely within your own mind, using, of course, visualized Buddhas or other things as a support. But the idea is that you are purifying through your own strong thoughts. Thoughts of regret, which is the first opponent power that we have that overcomes our negativities. Thoughts of reliance, which means restoring our sense of refuge in the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the teachings we're following, as well as generating bodhicitta, this positive mind. And then some form of a remedy, which is too a thought process, but also can also take the shape of reciting mantras or doing prostrations, various other things. And then finally, a thought of resolve, which is making the determination not to do those actions again to the best of our ability. Okay. So it doesn't require anything outside of ourselves. It's a thought process that we go into, and I'm not going to teach extensively on purification. That was just an introduction. There's many teachings out there about how we utilize these four opponent powers to purify our negative actions. But we target them specifically, and we diminish their power, and we sometimes can even be rid of them entirely so that they don't bring any results. So that's the first caveat or first footnote in regard to negative actions. In regard to positive actions, we interpret that interruption as being unless you have very powerful negative states of mind that weaken your positive potential. And this is a tricky thing that we, again, emphasizes why we need to be very meticulous in not getting angry. Anger is one of the most destructive emotions that we have, the most destructive emotion at the level of what it causes in the world around us. If we have moments of great inflammation of our minds and really getting angry, we can destroy our virtue. We can weaken those to that they don't bring forth results, or we can even get it to the point where they won't bring forth the kind of commensurate results. They'll be weakened in some way. So we have to be careful, because all the positive potential we're creating can be destroyed in a moment of anger. I mean, not all of it. And it would be kind of unfair in a sense, but certainly a good portion of what we've done can be weakened or destroyed by virtue of these negative states of mind. It shouldn't freak people out. I don't want to freak you out. Just know that, again, this is more impetus for us to learn how to be more patient, how to control the mind of anger, how to not get so caught up in that pattern that is like a small spark that can cause a whole forest fire. And we do see this in our world, all the destruction that happens by virtue of anger. Oh my God, 416. How did I get to 416? I just keep going. You have to stop me, Donna. Go. Okay. So those are the four characteristics. I'm sorry, I've kept you all here 15 minutes late, and you've all been so patient. It's good. Thank you for your patience. Let's conclude today with just a few prayers. And if there are any questions, I really would think it's better for us to hold on to those questions. Write them down so you don't forget them before you leave here today. And we'll start with questions in the afternoon again. This course continues in the afternoon. And we will touch on all eight of these. I will be abbreviated in what I can do by virtue of it not being, you know, that much time. But I will at least give a flavor for what these remaining six steps are, so that we make sure that there's at least some awareness of these. Let's go to the prayer book to page 235, and we'll just recite the first two prayers there that help us to seal all this that seal all of this positive potential so that we can achieve the greatest result of complete enlightenment for ourselves and others. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Then just dedicate in your own heart for, first of all, the good health and long lives of all of our spiritual teachers, especially His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, all the other teachers that we and others are connected with. And then lastly, to dedicate for those beings that you're holding in your heart that are experiencing various problems or difficulties. Maybe they have obstacles to their well-being or dealing with illness. Perhaps they're dying, or even those that have died, you know, in the recent past. Think that we're dedicating for their welfare so that they might be free from their suffering and achieve true peace and happiness. And may all beings find complete peace and happiness through our efforts here today. Thank you all again for your patience, and I apologize for keeping you here later. Get more for your money. Anyway, thank you all.